politics.
None of us know what's going on, but we do all know that something isn't right.
Deepfakes, polarizing algorithms, hate and conspiracy theories.
To me, there's no other logical explanation. That entire thing was staged.
Why Do You Hate Me, USA starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Monday afternoon at 4:30.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 17th of September. Good morning. This is Today with Justin Webb and Michelle Hussein.
The headlines this morning: universities in England are to tell the government that they need to put up tuition fees to tackle growing financial problems. But what do students get for the money? A listener tells us why she simply dropped out of her course.
I didn't have the best start. There were a lot of strikes in the first few weeks, so I didn't start for about a month in, which was not great because it's kind of start, stop, start, stop, and they don't really help you get stuck in. Like, if you don't turn up, they don't chase you about anything, they don't encourage you to like pick it back up, there's no kind of conversation about how you're feeling about anything.
One other headline: junior doctors say there's still a long way to go in their campaign for more pay after accepting a deal to end their long-running dispute. We'll be talking to the union at 7:10.
Also on the programme, in a rare interview, the head of the World Health Organization talks to us about what he has just seen of the humanitarian crisis sparked by Sudan's civil war.
There are many children, skin and bone, emaciated. And you can see also famine is in restricted areas like Al-Fasha and so on. But starvation is almost everywhere.
And in a real-life version of Succession, how the Murdochs are battling it out in a Nevada court. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Universities in England say tuition fees need to be increased in line with inflation to help prevent them from sliding into decline. Proposals by the organisation Universities UK have been shared exclusively with this programme. They call for more government support for both institutions and students. Vice-chancellors say the higher education system is at an inflection point and needs investment to continue offering world-renowned teaching and research. But students say they're already paying too much. Here's our education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
In proposals due to be released in the coming days, Universities UK will call for more investment from the government and students, the latter through an inflation-linked rise in tuition fees. The body, which represents more than 140 institutions, also wants maintenance grants to be increased and to ensure students have access to child and adolescent mental health services until they are 25. In England, tuition fees have been frozen at £9,250 for 7 years. The blueprint says universities are losing money teaching UK students. About 40% of universities are expecting to return a budget deficit this year. The Department for Education in England says it has inherited a challenging set of circumstances and it will create a secure future for universities.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has said the end of a pay dispute involving junior doctors in England marks the necessary first step in the government's mission to make the NHS fit for the future. Members of the British Medical Association have voted to accept an offer of a 22% rise over 2 years. But the union has warned that its pay campaign is not over. More details from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
There's been clear relief among health service managers at news that strikes are off the agenda as winter approaches. Patients will be relieved too. More than 1.5 million appointments and operations have been cancelled because of action by all health unions in England since the end of 2022. Wes Streeting said the dispute should never have been allowed to get to that state, and he'd negotiated an end to strikes in just 3 weeks of talks. The BMA said it was thanking members who'd stood on picket lines and fought for their worth, but the campaign was not over, and it still had a long way to go to achieve its aims on doctors' pay.
A report has highlighted serious concerns about the number of people off work because of long-term illness, describing Britain as the sick man of Europe. The think tank, the Institute for Public Policy Research, warns that figure could exceed 4 million by the end of the next Parliament, increasing pressure on the NHS and affecting economic productivity. Researchers have recommended moving from a policy based on treating sickness to one of creating better health by increasing taxes on tobacco, alcohol and unhealthy foods and offering universal free school meals. Donald Trump has spoken publicly for the first time since apparently being targeted in an assassination attempt at his golf course in Florida. Speaking in a live stream on the social media website X, the former president described hearing shots ringing out as the Secret Service opened fire on the suspected gunman. Mr. Trump also praised his protection team and, in a rare show of political unity, commended President Biden for calling him.
He was very nice today. He called up to make sure I was okay, to make sure that, do I have any suggestions or anything? Mm-hmm. We do need more people on my detail because we have 50, 60,000 people showing up to events. You know, other people don't have that. But he couldn't have been nicer.
40,000 residents of the city of Nysa in southwestern Poland have been told to head for higher ground as the Kłodzka River threatens to burst its banks. Several countries across Central and Eastern Europe are facing severe flooding caused by Storm Boris. At least 18 people have died. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, is to warn that crises in climate and nature are the defining challenges of our times. In his first major speech, he will announce plans to build an alliance of countries to accelerate the transition to clean energy. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlett.
Mr. Lammy is going to promise to create a global clean power alliance, a coalition of countries committed to boosting investment to accelerate the transition to renewable power around the world. He's expected to say that the threat of climate change is systemic, pervasive, and is accelerating towards us. The Foreign Secretary will also announce plans to appoint a special representative on climate change, a role withdrawn by the Conservatives last year. He will also announce the UK's first special representative on nature.
Blood samples taken from patients at a major hospital in London will be sent for urgent analysis by drone under a new pilot scheme. The trial will take place between Guy's Hospital and the lab at St Thomas Hospital. Officials say that the journey can take more than half an hour when using van or motorbike couriers, but with drones, samples can be transported in less than 2 minutes.
6 minutes past 6 is the time. Thank you for that. Let us turn to the weather. It was wonderful yesterday, at least it was in London. Helen Willetts is the person responsible for that and indeed for today as well. Morning, Helen.
Thank you very much, Justine. Good morning. Of course, the main problem yesterday was the dense fog across northern and western areas. Now, the fog is around this morning. It's not as widespread, but still just as hazardous if you encounter it on a faster route. So starting the detail with England and Wales, it's chilly first thing this morning. So again, you'll need the coat. You'll be shedding it this afternoon because we do have more sunshine on offer. Once again, as yesterday, temperatures getting into the high teens, low 20s, topping out around 21 or 22. The difference today for southeast England and East Anglia is there's quite a brisk northeasterly wind, so that will temper the feel, and it might also just bring a little bit more cloud at times, and for Kent possibly even the odd light shower, but we're clutching at straws for most. It's dry and fine and warm, as it will be across Northern Ireland. A little bit of mist and fog here two first thing, and a chilly start as well, but temperatures with lighter winds here will lift to between 19 and 21 degrees Celsius. I think a very pleasant day indeed. This high pressure that's dominating is drifting across northern England at the moment. It'll drift towards Scandinavia and stay with us for much of the week, and that applies to Scotland as well, but because of its position, it is allowing a weak weather front into the northern and western Isles of Scotland. There's a little bit of drizzly rain this morning and some cloud, low cloud, but it will be pulling away to the north, that weather front. So we'll see the sunshine coming out in Orkney and much of mainland Scotland. Of course, there could be a little bit of mist and fog here after the chilly start as well, but it might just stay cloudy for much of the day for the Western Isles and for Shetland. Highs 14, perhaps 22 or 23 around Moray.
Helen, thank you very much. It is 6:08, so let's have a look at the newspapers with several front pages expressing surprise and anger that the former BBC presenter Hugh Edwards was not sent to jail when he was sentenced yesterday for accessing indecent images of children. The Daily Telegraph says his suspended sentence has prompted accusations that sex crimes against children are being taken less seriously than offences involving social media comments. Campaigners also tell the paper the sentence sends the wrong message to offenders by suggesting they might not be sent to prison even if they have committed serious offences. The Daily Express says there's fury at Edwards' sentence. The Daily Mail's headline is "Disgraced, reviled, but not a day in jail." The Sun says many people will ask how Edwards avoided prison given what it calls the sickening revelations.
Yeah, the Daily Mail, the Times and the Telegraph all carry photographs of the Prime Minister's wife, Lady Victoria Starmer, attending London Fashion Week in a distinctive dress, navy spots on white, loaned to her by a designer. The Mail says it's another outfit she hasn't paid for, referring to what it calls wardrobe gate, the row over the clothes and other gifts given to the Prime Minister and his wife by the Labour donor, Lord Ali. The Telegraph says the entrepreneur also lent the couple a house at times during the election. Yesterday, Sir Keir said all politicians received gifts, and it was important to declare them.
The Guardian reports that growing concerns about how the story of the donations was apparently leaked have prompted ministers to pressure the head of the civil service to bring forward his expected departure. Simon Case is thought to be preparing to step down in January. The paper suggests number 10 insiders have become so frustrated by his apparent failure to get a grip on leaks, they would like to see him go sooner. A Cabinet Office spokesman denied that Mr. Case was the source of any leaks or negative briefing.
The Business Secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, tells The Times he wants to end what he calls the culture of presenteeism at work while working at home is frowned on. He says giving staff a default right to flexible working, allowing them to work from home, ignore work emails or calls in the evening, will keep them motivated and resilient. The government's due to publish an employment rights bill next month.
The Financial Times says the European Union is preparing to provide up to €40 billion, or about £34 billion, in unilateral loans to Ukraine, regardless of whether the United States comes on board to help. The paper says Brussels is mulling the move because of concerns that Hungary will try to delay a previous G7 proposal to use frozen Russian assets to help Kyiv.
And The Guardian and The Telegraph both report that the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, is to press ahead with his plan to pedestrianise Oxford Street. The Times says the thoroughfare is currently overcrowded, polluted and a hotspot for pickpockets. But the Mayor wants to create a European-style boulevard with planters, benches and water features.
The time is now 11 minutes past six.
Britain's health challenges have reached historic proportions, according to a report published today. Dominic Hughes is our health reporter. Who's telling us this, Dominic, and what's their solution or set of solutions?
Morning, Justin. Yeah, this is a report from the IPPR think tank. It's the culmination of 3 years of work by their health commission, which was chaired by Lord Aradhasi and also Dame Sally Davis, the former chief medical officer for England.
Gosh, Lord Darcy's busy, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. So he diagnosed some of the serious problems facing the NHS in his review last week, but this week he's now offering some solutions in his role as co-chair of this commission. But yeah, he has been busy. One of the key issues they identify is this huge number of people who are off work around the UK due to long-term sickness, currently around 2.8 million. But they say that's 900,000 more than if the trends up to when the pandemic hit in 2020 had continued. But more alarmingly, perhaps, they say by the end of the next parliament, so in 10 years' time, that number could reach 4.3 million. Now, that all has an impact, obviously, on economic productivity, on tax revenues, and it also increases pressure on the NHS. And their solution is to suggest moving from a policy that's based on treating sickness. So rather than waiting for people to fall ill, you create one that creates better health. And they outline measures, including taxation on what they call health polluters. And those are things like tobacco, alcohol and unhealthy foods. But then also offering universal free school meals, restoring funding for the Sure Start programme for the very youngest, for the under fives, establishing neighbourhood health centres and offering what's been described as what they call a right to try work for those who are off sick with no risk to existing health or disability benefits.
Yeah, and it's the old story, isn't it? That they're going to say, I mean, the obvious response to some of those things is to say, well, that's expensive and the government doesn't seem minded to spend money at the moment. But presumably they will tell us, and we're going to hear from them at 10 to 8, they will tell us that long term you will save money and save lives by doing all of this.
Yes, and exactly that. And that some of these things will, in the long term, pay for themselves because they draw this link between the health of the nation and the health of the economic health of the nation and the physical health of the nation. They say that, you know, one of the key things that has seen our economic productivity lag so badly is the number of people who are off on long-term sick. Yeah. So they say there is that link, absolutely.
OK, well, look, Dominic, thank you very much for that. And we will be hearing from Dame Sally Davis, who was co-chair of the commission, because Lord Darcy can't do it all himself, at 10 to 8.
13 minutes past six is the time. Donald Trump has been speaking overnight about what could have been another attempt on his life on Sunday when a gunman now in custody hid for 12 hours by the side of one of his golf courses. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes has been speaking to me.
Donald Trump spoke in some length about what had happened, almost a minute account of when he first heard gunshots. He said he heard four or five shots and the Secret Service around him knew immediately what it was. And he also referred to a conversation that he'd had with President Biden a few hours earlier. The White House, in fact, had confirmed that Mr. Biden and Donald Trump had spoken, the president, to convey his relief that Donald Trump was safe. It was a cordial conversation, and Donald Trump later said, in fact, that it had been a nice conversation and that the president had asked for suggestions. They'd been talking about civil service protection, and it seems that there's actually some rare political consensus here that the Secret Service needs more resources, though, so that the security of the former president can be stepped up.
And is it now on a par with Joe Biden's?
It seems it's moving in that direction. It was interesting at the first news conference after what happened on Sunday. It was explained that the entire golf course hadn't been covered by the Secret Service. This was a fairly impromptu decision by the former president to have a round of golf, and he was essentially only covered for the next couple of holes that he was approaching, and it was in one of those situations that the Secret Service agent spotted a rifle coming through the trees on the perimeter of the golf course. But it's since been explained that as far as Mar-a-Lago is concerned, Donald Trump's home in Florida, that the security there now is very, very similar to what it was when he was president. So it has been significantly stepped up. It was explained that the golf course, had he been the president, would have been completely covered, as opposed to just that relatively minimal coverage, because it was an impromptu decision to go for a round of golf.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
16 minutes past six. What is happening with our trade with Europe? Nothing very good, it would seem. Sean is here with that and the rest of the morning's business news. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Justin. Well, this is a report out today that looks at the goods industry in particular. So products flowing between the two trading areas, like those coming exports from the UK, from farming, clothing makers, wooden paper manufacturers, they've been hit hard. Imports have been hit too. And this report from Aston Business School's Centre for Business Prosperity says that the levels of those imports and exports of goods, the stuff that's made in the UK and the EU, fell about 30% between 2021 and 2023. Here's Mary Quick, who's the owner of Quick's Cheeses in Devon, one business that's seen a similar trend.
We used to have four customers that we supplied direct in the EU and a number of other people we supplied indirectly. And that has gone down. As a little business, we find it really, really difficult to deal with all the regulatory burdens. We now no longer supply those companies direct. We had to give them away to somebody else. We just don't have the people to do the paperwork.
Now, the report doesn't look at the services sector, which has outperformed the expectations of many since the UK left the European Union, but it does look at goods. And I've got June Du with me, who is Professor of Economics and one of the authors of the research. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
So let's have a look at the stuff we make and what we get that's made from the European Union. Why is it that this level of trade that you've looked at has fallen?
Well, overall, I guess the trade cost increase has been significant. And what we observe is that 3 years down the line, the UK now trades less in value and variety with the EU as a result of Brexit. So that applies for both exports and imports. One of the reasons that it falls is because it's increased non-tariff measures. Non-tariff measures are basically rules and regulations that countries use to control for the amount of trade that are coming in or going out without the traditional measures of tariffs and quotas. These measures can include, for example, product standards, safety checks, and labeling requirements. While these measures do protect consumers and competition and the environment, they also increasingly bring difficulties and cost for the traders.
Yeah, and we heard Mary there talking about exactly the kind of paperwork that's needed, the extra layers that are required to get her cheese to the same customer in France or wherever it might be around the European Union. But I just want, when you look at the numbers overall and you see the consequences of this overall, what are those consequences of a fall in trade?
Well, the consequences directly for exporters, they don't no longer find trading profitable. And while they cannot redirect their trade somewhere else, they have to reduce their production and trade profit. And in some cases, they have to go bust. But in more indirect way, imports are important for exports, and exports generally are important for productivity. So given that we have productivity conundrum here and long-term challenge, this will have deep implication for the UK economy as a whole.
What's gone on with the UK's trade elsewhere? I know that might not be specifically what you've looked at in this report, but it's an important part of it, isn't it? If we're trading less in the goods sector with the European Union, have British businesses shifted to other economies around the world?
In some cases, indeed, Sean, trade redirection happens when some markets become more expensive to trade. In this case, though, for exports, UK has not really been successfully redirecting trade to the rest of the world, especially for the industries which are not very easy to redirect. We see imports are redirecting to other countries more prominently.
Now, the services sector, which this report doesn't look at, it makes up more than 80% of the stuff we produce and what we do here in the UK, a huge part of our economy. How does that compare, do you think, to the numbers you've looked at here? Because, you know, many might think that actually it's performed a lot better, and that's what we're really strong at.
That might be the case. This report doesn't look at service trade. And service trade, as far as I know, there has been no causal analysis as we do for goods in this report. I think UK has merit advantages in trade in services indeed, but there's a huge heterogeneity. I mean, differences across different sectors. In some sectors, they might be more impacted than others. And some service sectors are very closely related with goods. So while goods falling, some service sectors will be impacted negatively as well.
June, thank you very much. June Dew there, Professor of Economics from the Aston Business School Centre for Business Prosperity. Over to the United States now, where Boeing is resuming its talks with unions today as worker strikes continue to place fresh pressure on the troubled plane maker. Last week, we saw 30,000 workers there vote in favour of strikes. 96% of them did that. And they'll be the first strikes Boeing has seen since 2008. Has a ripple effect to the industry here in Europe. Could hit the likes of Ryanair, as the boss there, Michael O'Leary, says the new manufacturing delays may reduce the number of planes it gets next year. Judson Rollins is a senior consultant at the aviation consultancy Liam Co. Morning, Judson.
Good morning.
So how damaging could this be for Boeing? If Ryanair, even in the early stages, is talking about fewer planes it's going to get, could this have a ripple effect right across the industry?
Absolutely. And not just on airlines, but also on all of the small, medium, and large suppliers that feed Boeing as well. If you look at the history of machinist strikes at Boeing, the average machinist strike this century has taken about 77 days to resolve. And the last time Boeing had a strike, it was a 58-day strike, and it cost the company $6 billion U.S. dollars in revenue and $2.5 billion in cash flow. So the company right now is scrambling to institute a number of cost control measures that are going to affect charitable partners, suppliers, employees, just about everyone who has a stake in Boeing's success.
Yeah, this new management at Boeing scrambling to resolve a fair few issues regarding Boeing's reputation. And it seems if the likes of Michael O'Leary at Ryanair, unconvinced by this new management, saying it continues to disappoint, is Boeing going to be able to turn all of this around with the tragic disasters it's had with some of its aircraft over recent years, the non-stop bad headlines it's generating?
Yes, it absolutely is possible, but it's going to require much deeper management change. All you've seen so far is a change at the CEO at the corporate level. It's going to require a much deeper change in the senior management levels within the commercial airplanes division in particular. And we haven't seen any major changes since Kelly Ortberg came in as the new CEO. There's a lot more to come, and I don't think those changes will make so many headlines.
And what will happen if this issue with workers continues for an extended period, the aerospace industry more broadly? Are customers going to be affected by the flights they're trying to get? Defense sectors going to have a knock-on effect as well?
This strike really is more about the civilian production line, so I don't think you're going to see many defense industry impacts. With regard to the airlines, it's just going to be more of the same. Boeing's output, even before the strike, is less than half what it was at its 2018 peak because of supply chain issues, because of quality assurance problems. And so, yeah, airlines are going to continue to see delays in getting new airplanes, which means they're going to have to hold on to older airplanes for longer.
Judson, thank you. Judson Rollins there from the aviation consultancy Liam Coe. Freddie Cahoon was listening to that, investment director here in the UK at JM Finn. Freddie, how are you viewing the aerospace industry at the moment?
Yeah, well, it's just another example of the challenges that all these players are facing. I mean, you know, Boeing is fighting fires across its business. And I think the one word that's is really prevalent here is trust, you know, trust for its customers and trust for its employees, you know, and the culture of that firm also needs to be looked at. So I agree. I think there's going to be more management changes needed there.
Freddie, a week ago, we were talking about the latest developments at Apple, new iPhone out. Artificial intelligence was the big thing. The pre-orders were due in by the end of the week. So you're starting to get a little bit of data of how much your shoppers and smartphone owners are keen for this over the course of the weekend. And Apple shares were down a little bit yesterday. Some concerns?
Yeah, they fell a little bit yesterday. I mean, a couple of percent only. But it was the first analyst reports we started to see about how the sales were shaping up for the first weekend of the iPhone 16 Pro and Pro Max sales. First impressions are that the pre-orders and orders are down about 12% on the of last year's iPhone 15 launch. But still, that's pre-orders of about 37 million units. So I think we'll just have to see how this evolves. You know, the cost of the unit itself is not cheap. It's £999 when it retails in the UK. So I think consumers are going to need to be convinced that the new technology and the new battery power within this unit is going to justify the increased cost.
In the paper review a little earlier, Justin Michel talking about this story on the front of the Times, working at home boosts productivity, says Labour. Meanwhile, Amazon has told staff they've got to be back in the office 5 days a week, the latest company to try and crack down on remote working. Is there going to be a bit of a clash here in the UK, do you think, between government message and what businesses actually want from their workers?
I think that could be. I mean, I think it's the productivity discussion is different across many sectors within the economy here. It is interesting to see what the CEO was saying at Amazon here, saying, you know, he wants employees back in the office to enable to invent, collaborate and connect properly with each other. I think that's an important point. He's always been a bit cynical of the hybrid working policy anyway. But I think, you know, many of the listeners here will be, you know, sort of concerned that some areas of the service sector are not bad at hybrid working, but other areas, perhaps such as government departments, where there seems to be some friction, is still challenged. So I think this debate will continue for a number of months.
Freddie, good to catch up with you. Thanks for joining us. Freddie Cahoon, the investment director at JM Finn. I'm going to be back after seven talking to the boss of Holland and Wolf, the big shipbuilder struggling at the moment, heading into administration. We'll try and figure out what exactly is going to happen next for those 1,500 or so workers there.
Sean, thank you very much. 27 minutes past six. Cathy has this morning's sport. Hello, Cathy.
Morning. Thank you very much. The Champions League returns tonight with a new format involving more clubs and one single table. Manchester City, Arsenal, Liverpool, Aston Villa and Celtic are all involved in the prestigious European club competition over the next three nights. The BBC's senior football reporter Ian Dennis has details of those changes.
On the eve of a new Champions League campaign, Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson was critical of the intense playing schedule. A revamped competition means extra games, to which the Brazilian said, "Nobody asked the players, so maybe our opinion doesn't matter." 8 games instead of 6, with one league consisting of 36 sides playing in a Swiss-style format, replaces the group stages. Alisson says they're not close to finding a solution to ease the footballing calendar, which has 3 successive days of games in Europe's elite competition. Aston Villa at Young Boys is the early game, followed by Liverpool in Milan at San Siro, while Manchester City against Inter takes place on Wednesday, followed on Thursday by Atalanta against Arsenal.
The Aston Villa manager Unai Emery wants his side to win their opening Champions League game tonight against Young Boys in memory of the club's European Cup winner Gary Shaw, who died yesterday at the age of 63. Shaw was in the Aston Villa team that won the competition in 1982. Tonight's game is Villa's first in Europe's top-tier club competition in 41 years. There's commentary of that game on 5 Live from 5:45. Last night, Birmingham City beat Wrexham 3-1 in a match that had bigger names off the pitch than on it. Former NFL quarterback Tom Brady is a co-owner of Birmingham City and had David Beckham and Gary Neville in his box alongside him, while Hollywood actor Rob McElhenney, a co-owner of Wrexham, was also at the game. Wrexham remain top of League One, with Birmingham City in second place. Boxing, and Anthony Joshua says he has been through a lot of pain over the last 2 years as he bids to become a three-time world champion when he faces fellow British heavyweight Daniel Dubois on Saturday. The 2012 Olympic champion believes he has rebuilt himself as he prepares to fight in front of 96,000 fans at Wembley Stadium.
I feel better now. I feel better for sure. But more seasoned, hardened, a lot more development, not so much dependent on one or two things in the ring. I have a lot of tricks up my sleeve. Been the 12 rounds. My punching power's improved. Defence has improved. Yeah, feel good. Feel much better than I used to.
And Lord Coe, currently president of World Athletics, has been named as one of seven confirmed candidates to succeed Thomas Bach as the president of the International Olympic Committee.
Cathy, thank you. Rethink returns this week.
I'm Professor Ben Ansell, and in BBC Radio 4's Rethink, I'll be taking a fresh look at some of the big issues of our time. Sometimes it feels like information is coming at us from every angle. And so, with the experts, I'm going to assess the assumptions and reassess the research for issues from immigration to voting to how much things cost, and consider how we might approach these things differently and make our world a better place. So join me, Ben Ansell, for a new series of Rethink on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting this Thursday afternoon at 4.
The time is now just after 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb, Michelle Hussein and Jane Steele with the news.
Universities in England are to tell the government tuition fees need to be increased in line with inflation to help prevent them from sliding into decline. These fees have been frozen for 7 years and around 40% of universities are expecting to return a budget deficit this year. Proposals by the organisation Universities UK, seen exclusively by this programme, call for more government support for both institutions and students. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has said the end of a pay dispute by junior doctors in England marks the first step in the government's mission to make the NHS fit for the future. Members of the British Medical Association voted to accept an offer of a 22% pay rise over 2 years. A new report has highlighted serious concerns about the number of people off work because of long-term illness, describing Britain as the sick man of Europe. Researchers recommend moving from a policy based on treating sickness to one of improving health by increasing taxes on tobacco, alcohol and unhealthy foods and offering universal free school meals. Donald Trump has spoken publicly for the first time since a suspected assassination attempt at his golf course in Florida. In a live stream on social media, he praised his protection team and commended President Biden for his response, saying he couldn't have been nicer. The head of the World Health Organization has described the situation in Sudan as very alarming. Thousands of people have died in the country since a civil war broke out in April last year between the army and the paramilitary RSF. In an interview for this programme, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said nearly half of Sudan's population of 25 million people had fled their homes and starvation was almost everywhere. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, is to warn that crises in climate and nature are the defining challenges of our times. In his first major speech, he will announce plans to create an alliance of countries to accelerate the transition to clean energy.
Jane, thank you very much. We are going to be talking on the programme a fair amount about universities this morning, the experience and the value of that level of education. That is because we've had an exclusive preview of proposals from Universities UK, which represents 142 institutions and which wants tuition fees to rise urgently. Vanessa Clark, our education correspondent, joins us. What's the level that they are envisaging, Vanessa?
Well, this looks particularly at England, where tuition fees have been frozen at £9,250 for the last 7 years. And they're calling for the government to increase funding through a combination of index linking fees to inflation, so a rise in tuition fees linked to inflation and government investment. And the proposals say universities lose money teaching UK students. We have to halt that. If investment in teaching students had kept up with inflation, funding per student would be in the region of £12 to £13. It comes as around 40% of universities are predicting a budget deficit this year. But as the Higher Education Policy Institute told me, you know, it's very politically difficult to put up tuition fees. You know, the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, promised to support scrapping fees during his leadership campaign in 2020, but later abandoned the pledge. And it's also not an easy move with the cost of living so high for students. I spoke to some in Manchester about this possibility, and it's fair to say it did not go down well. When it comes to tuition fees, you only pay them back once you are earning over a certain threshold. But the cost of living is still very high. It's around £18,000 to live for students, and many are working longer hours. Now, on the other hand, the government is choosing very carefully where it is putting taxpayers' money. And the question is higher education something they're willing to move on?
So this £12,000 to £13,000 figure that it seems is the one they are hoping for, they're not saying, are they, how much of that would come from an increase to tuition fees and how much they think should come from government?
No, they're citing that as if inflation had kept up, or if their rise in tuition fees had kept up over the last 7 years. That's, I suppose, what they need in order to fund lectures, in order to, you know, keep things the way they are at the moment. The chair of the Russell Group said the harsh reality is the options are, this comes from students, are the taxpayers. You know, universities have recruited more international students in recent years who pay higher fees, but actually in the first 6 months of this year, those numbers are down by about 17%. So there is a hole forming there, a gap, and they say that, you know, if this is not filled, we will begin to see bigger class sizes, less lectures, and if we want to keep it the way it is, then it needs to rise very quickly.
Vanessa Clark, thanks very much.
It is 25 to 7. The threat of strikes in the NHS over the coming months has been lifted, it seems, as has the threat of a parliamentary standards investigation into Keir Starmer's wife's clothes. Let's talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, who's on the line. The junior doctors, first of all, Henry, and presumably a lot of pleasure in government. Some trepidation, though, about what might follow in the months ahead?
Certainly a lot of pleasure in government, Justin. And indeed, Wes Streeting, the health secretary, yesterday suggested a lot of pleasure across the country. He said this deal would be a huge source of relief for everyone in the country. I mean, 2.5 months or so into this government, it is a clear difference with the previous government here, isn't it? This is not a deal that the previous government would have been willing to strike. The Labour Party, the new Labour health secretary, the new Labour government take the view that this political choice to spend more money on doctors' pay in the hope that that will deal with strikes, not just for now, but for good, will enable them to get on with reducing waiting lists, with NHS reform, which they say sits at the heart of their plans for the health service. And as with their choice to spend more money on settling other disputes, such as the train drivers, the slight fear, but I think it is only slight for now in government, though, of course, is that there does seem to still be a relatively sizable contingent of junior doctors who are adamant that if pay doesn't continue to rise with inflation, or if the government doesn't start to move towards what they call pay restoration, because they say in real terms pay is still way below where it was in 2008, then the prospect of strikes could loom again.
And we'll be hearing from the co-chair of the Junior Doctors Committee of the BMA at 7:10. Meanwhile, lots of pictures of Lady Starmer in the papers today, looking very stylish. Is this going away now? Does Downing Street, do politicians more generally think that Keir Starmer put to bed the business of the clothing bought for his wife, and indeed the things that he has also benefited from a Labour donor?
Well, in sort of practical, immediate terms, yes, this is fading. We understand that Downing Street has been told by Daniel Greenberg, who's the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards, that he's not going to open an investigation into the £5,000 or so worth of clothes and personal shopping that was provided to Victoria Starmer by Lord Alley. And that would seem to support Keir Starmer's contention yesterday that this was all proactively raised by him with the Commissioner and with the Commissioner's Registrar, out of an abundance of determination to do the right thing. But I do think more generally, politically, there is a bit of unease among some people I speak to in the Labour Party, in the government about this. You know, there are prime ministers before and there will be prime ministers in the future who've been enmeshed in sort of questions about declarations of certain things. But Keir Starmer specifically, part of his appeal as he took the fight to Boris Johnson and then ultimately won the general election, was to draw a line under skirmishes like this. And the political risk for him is that stories like this, whether they end up being formally investigated by parliamentary commissioners or not, undermine his ability to do so.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
It is nearly 20 to 7. Water levels on the Danube in Hungary are rising sharply after heavy rain and flooding in recent days that affected a large area of Central Europe, including Romania, the Czech Republic and Poland, from where correspondent Sarah Rainsford joins us. And I know you've seen the flood hit area, Sarah. What is it like at the moment?
Yeah, Michelle, I'm in Nysa, which is in southwestern Poland, not far from the Czech border. And it was a pretty dramatic night last night. There were sirens going all night, helicopters overhead, and a huge team of volunteers who'd gathered here on the riverbank to stuff sandbags and to form a human chain and to get those bags down to the embankment. Because I'm just looking across the very swollen river here that runs through Nysa now. And there is a section of the embankment that essentially was collapsing. And so this volunteer army was brought in to stuff that with sandbags and to try to stop the town being flooded completely. The mayor had put out a very dramatic and slightly alarming warning for people, saying that if the embankment were to collapse, then there would be a wall of water heading for the town. So he ordered an emergency evacuation, and we saw people heading out of town yesterday to higher ground. I have to say, looking across the river now, though, it's still a very swollen river, much higher than usual, but the water level has fallen back. We've been here in this region for 3 days now, and definitely the sun has come out today, the rains have stopped, and the water levels are falling. But there's still been a huge amount of pressure because, of course, the torrential rain... That hit the mountain areas of the Czech Republic, that water has still been cascading down the mountains, filling the reservoirs and putting pressure on the rivers. And we've been seeing, when even the floodwaters subside, the horrible dirt and filth and devastation that they leave behind. Lots of people we've been speaking to in the villages around here who've lost an awful lot in this flood. And of course, across Central and Eastern Europe, several people have lost their lives, people who've been carried away by the flood water, and people still missing too.
Yeah, about seven people drowned in Romania. For where you are people shocked by the extent of all of this? Have they experienced anything like this before? Because it is the month of September and there have been these huge amounts of rain and snow in the Austrian Alps that seem to have triggered this.
Yeah, and you know, torrential rains that have come after an extraordinarily hot summer here in Poland. It's been extremely hot for several months. So I think the weather is definitely unusual. I think people are surprised in that sense. But they are remembering as well a giant flood in 1997. You talk to lots of people here, and that's what they mention. They say the last time they saw this was in 97. They called it the Great Floods or the Millennium Flood, and there were more than 100 people then who lost their lives. And I think the thing that people are saying this time is that they do feel at least that this region, all the countries involved, were better prepared, you know, much better floodgates, much better protections and preparations in place. But it still has been really very damaging and distressing for everyone who's been caught up in it. But I have to say, I think the water levels are dropping now, and I think the pressure is decreasing, although the mayor here has suggested there's another hole on the embankment further up the river from here that they're now working to plug.
Sarah Rainsford, thank you.
It is 18 minutes to 7. Let's have a look at the front pages of the papers. And most of them have an image of an unshaven Hugh Edwards. Hugh Edwards' shame is the headline in the Mirror. Newsreader paid pedo for sickening child abuse images. He betrayed audiences who put trust in him, say the BBC. Their headline is appalling. Hugh Edwards avoids jail over images of child abuse. There's quite a lot of surprise expressed in several of the papers at what they see as the leniency of his sentence, particularly when compared to those who were sentenced for the recent riots. Hugh Edwards given suspended jail term over indecent images. That same photo on the front page of The Guardian and The Sun, again, that says the full scale of the depravity of the disgraced Hugh Edwards emerged yesterday, and is also on the front of the Times, although with the reminder that his reputation, as the judge told him, is now in tatters.
Inside the papers, quite a lot of rather lovely looking visualisations of what Oxford Street could look like in London if the Mayor of London's plans materialise over the next couple of years. It's the busy shopping street is largely closed to private traffic, but it could have planters, seating and other features transforming it. Under the mayor's plans, which are being unveiled today, he says it suffered over the past decade. Urgent action is needed to give it a new lease of life. The idea is that the carriageway is going to be converted into an open space with places to sit and socialise, also space for art installations and the banning of buses and taxis from the street.
The time is just coming up to 6:45. The main headline this morning, a blueprint for the future of universities in England, seen by this programme, includes a call for a rise in tuition fees linked to inflation.
India's Supreme Court is to issue new guidelines on property demolitions in the face of what has been called bulldozer justice, where people accused of crime have their homes destroyed by state authorities, often those where the ruling BJP party is in power. Critics have said it's a tactic often used to target the minority Muslim community. The reason usually cited is illegal construction. Our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain reports from the central state of Madhya Pradesh.
I'm standing in front of a pile of broken bricks and rocks with steel rods and wires that are all twisted up that just lay in a pile of rubble. I can see a pair of sneakers, some broken mirrors, and even the head of a plastic doll. This used to be Asya Bano's home, but one day in June, authorities came and bulldozed it to the ground.
Social media videos show the moment police entered the village, accusing Asya Bano's husband, a Muslim, of having beef, which is illegal in most Indian states. By morning, authorities bulldozed her house, saying it was illegally built on public land. Overcome with grief, Asya Bano sits in a pile of rubble and broken dreams.
Where will we go now? We were taking shelter in other people's homes. All our belongings are buried. But what pains me the most is that I lost my daughter too.
Her daughter, 16-year-old Zenith, died of pneumonia just 6 weeks after her home was demolished. Asya Bano is convinced it was because she was forced to sleep outside with no shelter from the monsoons.
Asya Bano's home is not the only one that was destroyed. Actually, along this narrow one-lane dirt road, there's about 26 homes that make up this community. But on that June day, authorities came in and bulldozed almost half of the homes. Homes being bulldozed of people that are accused of crimes. And that's why the Supreme Court is taking it up. Authorities are saying, well, some of these are illegally built, or the building itself is unstable or unsafe and has to come down. Amnesty International has documented quite a few of these cases across the country in the last few years, and they say the reasonings are much more sinister.
It's not always the case that it is those who dissent who are targeted, but it is generally the case that it's those people the government doesn't like. And it is most often the case that these are minorities, particularly Muslims.
Agar Patel is the chair of Amnesty International here in India.
None of the due process is actually followed, which is why the Supreme Court has taken an interest in this. There is a system that the government must follow. There is a due process which it doesn't actually respect. They go about raising people's homes for no reason other than the fact that these people are Muslim.
The government didn't reply to our requests for comment, but has repeatedly denied it preys on minorities. Listen to this clip from the Chief Minister of Uttar Pradesh, Yogi Adityanath, where he pushes back against allegations that Muslim homes are unfairly targeted.
Show me one Muslim who can say I was innocent and has been a victim of injustice. Show me one. Nobody can say this.
A busy street in the city of Ujjain.
Police are making an announcement. We will use the harshest punishment. They're talking about Muslim boys who allegedly spat on a Hindu procession. The video went viral last year. The boys, Ashraf Mansouri's sons. The harsh punishment, razing his home to the ground, as a devotional Hindu song echoes in the neighborhood.
They put up a notice saying the building is structurally unsafe and will be demolished. Take what you can, you have an hour.
Merely accused of a crime, and the entire family pays the price.
We are in no condition to build it all over again. You cannot build a house just like that.
Despite India's highest court taking up the issue, none of the victims I spoke with actually believe that anything will change.
That was Samira Hussain reporting. It brings us to, just come up to 10 to 7. Antibiotic-resistant infections are going to be a bigger and bigger threat, and we need to act now to react to that threat. A project called the Global Research on Antibiotic Resistance Project has been published in The Lancet. This is its latest report, and it's a worrying one in many ways. Let us talk to Dr. Yanana Restingham, who is the CEO of the Wellcome Trust and is on the line now. Good morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What does the report tell us that we didn't already know?
Yeah, this is really a comprehensive global report, the first in its type, and that documents how antibiotic resistance has evolved over the last 30 years. It documents that we lose more than 1 million lives every year from antibiotic resistance over these last 30 years. But it also predicts the future, and it indicates that this will increase. It may increase up to 70% in annual deaths. So it's a huge public health concern across the world. But the biggest toll is, as always, in low and middle income countries.
Yeah, and it's the scale of it that is really striking, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's, in a way, you and I will probably be surprised because, in a way, antibiotic resistance is not one disease. It's a combination of disease across different hospital departments. It's in respiratory infections, pneumonia, urinary tract infections, gastroenteritis, and it happens among children, in geriatric wards, in emergency wards, in orthopedic surgery, and in even cancer departments. So this is a problem across healthcare, and it really speaks to the need to tackle it because we really rely on antibiotics to deliver modern medicine.
The study finds, doesn't it, that deaths among children under five because of these issues is actually falling, which is a positive thing, isn't it? Why is it that deaths among children under five are falling and yet among older people are rising?
Yeah, that's a very promising and a positive message, as you say. The challenge is to describe it and explain it. And the main reason is really because we have been successful internationally in preventing infection among children. We have increased vaccination rates. We have improved water and sanitation and hygiene measures. So that has led to fewer infections among children. But actually, the proportion of infections that are resistant is not going down. It's probably rather increasing. But in some because of the prevention, we actually see reduced number of deaths, which is a really positive message. And it demonstrates that we can have impact if we take collective action.
And what about, just finally, thought about new antibiotics? Because that's also a potential solution, isn't it? Are we getting them? Have we got the proper incentives in place to get them?
No, and that's an increasing problem. We need to keep up with the evolution of resistance. We need to steadily develop new antibiotics, and we are doing the opposite. And that's because of lack of sufficient incentives. New antibiotics are not used every day. They're used as a second and third line resource, and when the first line fail. And that means that the commercial incentives are insufficient. Countries like UK have started subscription models to actually incentivize. That needs international collective action. And that's why it's so important that next week we have the UN General Assembly having its second high-level meeting on antimicrobial resistance. And I hope political leaders will take action and actually commit to more working together on these issues.
Dr. Yanana Restingham, CEO at Wellcome, thank you very much.
Sir,
7:07.
The UK is to set up a global clean power alliance, the Foreign Secretary will say today, helping more countries to have renewable energy at the core of their power generation systems. It is part of the run-up to the next COP climate conference, which will be in Azerbaijan in November. Alok Sharma joins us, former Conservative MP and minister who led the COP26 meeting in Glasgow. Morning, Lord Sharma.
Morning, Michelle.
If this is going to make a real difference, what do you think it should involve?
I think it's very important that he's making this speech. I think it signals that the government is focused on climate action. I think we obviously need to hear the substance of this. It is a fact that 75% of global emissions are energy related. And, you know, if the world is to have any hope of meeting its emission reduction targets, you're going to have to tackle those fossil fuel emissions. And you talked about the next COP. At the last COP in Dubai, the world agreed that, you know, we would transition away from fossil fuels in our energy systems. And for that to happen, we need to be tripling the amount of renewables capacity around the world. Now, if this global clean power alliance can actually practically help to deliver new renewable capacity at pace, not just in developed countries, but also in developing economies, then yes, I mean, I think it has a potential to play a pretty important role. But I think what we also need to understand is the substance and the detail of how this will be done, and very importantly, money, because that's the other missing ingredient. We need to see more money from public, but also very much in the private sector to fund these new clean power projects.
Because the problem is that developing countries do rely not just on fossil fuels to a large extent, but actually on the dirtiest, on coal to a large extent. And if, as this announcement suggests, the UK wants them to leapfrog oil and gas, for example, and transition straight to wind, solar and hydropower, that is a very, very big shift, which even in the richest countries, we're having trouble fully funding.
Well, I think, you know, you said it's about a transition. I think that's what it is. So no one is suggesting that this happens overnight. But we also know that actually, you know, climate change and biodiversity loss are getting worse. That's having a negative impact on millions of lives and livelihoods around the world. Many of those people living in developing countries. So I think it's vitally important that developed nations do support developing countries to make that leap to move from dirty to clean power. We did some of this work, during the COP26 process, trying to support developing economies. But you're right, finance is the key part of this. And there is a wall of money from the private sector which wants to invest in these sort of projects. But we need to make sure that they're able to get a return. We need to support developing countries, develop their regulatory environments. We need to be, frankly, doing more in pushing the multilateral development banks, people like the World Bank, to sweat their balance sheets a lot more so finance can be made available.
So you mean that we could be, the UK could be some kind of bridge between the private sector, which wants to invest more in solar or wind or hydropower in countries where they feel they don't have the certainty to do so?
Well, the UK obviously has a part to play, and we have shown climate leadership in the work we did on COP26. But it's about how the UK works together with other countries and other institutions to catalyse not just public but also private sector money. And that, I think, is going to be one of the key things that I'm certainly looking out for in terms of the speech that the Foreign Secretary is giving today.
Alok Sharma, thank you very much.
3 minutes to seven to the sunshine and Helen Willits.
Thank you very much indeed, Justin. Hello there. Good morning. Yes, we've got high pressure dominating, if you haven't yet heard. So this week it means it's going to feel really lovely and warm for most of us by day. It's chilly, though, by night. So across England and Wales, temperatures have fallen within a couple of degrees of freezing in some parts overnight, 2 or 3 degrees. And there's a little bit of mist and fog around, not as extensive as it was yesterday morning. But otherwise, it's fine. It's dry. There'll be plenty of sunshine, a little bit of fair weather cloud building up as we go through the day, particularly across the southeast of England and East Anglia, where for Kent, for example, there might just be the odd light shower, but few and far between. Most will stay dry. What we do have, though, here is a brisk northeast wind compared with yesterday, so that'll temper the feel. It'll be more like 18 or 19, whilst many areas will get to around well, 20, 21 degrees Celsius today, possibly a degree higher. So feeling pleasantly warm, as it will do across Northern Ireland. It's a bit of a chilly start here as well. We've got some fair weather cloud mulling around already, but there'll be some sunshine as well. Any mist or fog will clear and temperatures will top out around about 20 to 21 degrees Celsius. Slightly more complicated for Scotland, only in that we have the remnants of a weather front sitting across the Northern and Western Isles, giving a little bit of morning drizzle and mist. That's pulling away northwards, so it'll dry up at least and brighten up, but we might only see a little bit of sunshine coming through in Orkney, whereas for mainland, mist and fog clears, the chilly starts, and then temperatures actually might get up to 22 to 23 around Moray Firth. So very warm indeed for this time of year.
Helen, thank you very much.
It's been a summer of spectacular concerts from the BBC Proms, with stunning performances and unique collaborations. Culminating in the world's biggest classical music party. Listen to every prom on BBC Sounds.
And coming up in the next hour on this programme, a pay rise of more than 20% over 2 years for junior doctors. Is this the end of strikes in the NHS? We have a rare interview with the head of the World Health Organization following his trip to Sudan. We're playing that at 7:30. And real-life succession playing out in a Nevada courtroom. Rupert Murdoch's fight for the future of his empire.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 17th of September. The headlines this morning: university vice-chancellors are calling for a rise in tuition fees in England to alleviate the growing financial problems they say many institutions are facing. Junior doctors say their pay campaign is not over despite voting to accept a new deal to end their long-running dispute. And President Trump has spoken of the moment he heard shots ring out during an apparent assassination attempt as he was playing golf. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Universities in England say tuition fees need to be increased in line with inflation to help prevent them from sliding into decline. Proposals by the organisation Universities UK have been shared exclusively with this programme. They call for more government support for both institutions and students. Vice-chancellors say the higher education system is at an inflection point and needs investment to continue offering world-renowned teaching and research. But students say they are already paying too much. More details from our education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
In proposals due to be released in the coming days, Universities UK will call for more investment from the government and students, the latter through an inflation-linked rise in tuition fees. The body, which represents more than 140 institutions, also wants maintenance grants to be increased and to ensure students have access to child and adolescent mental health services until they are 25. In England, tuition fees have been frozen at £9,250 for 7 years. The blueprint says universities are losing money teaching UK students. About 40% of universities are expecting to return a budget deficit this year. The Department for Education in England says it has inherited a challenging set of circumstances and it will create a secure future for universities.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has said the end of a pay dispute involving junior doctors in England marks the necessary first step in the government's mission to make the NHS fit for the future. Members of the British Medical Association have voted to accept an offer of a 22% rise over 2 years, but the union has warned that its pay campaign is not over. More details from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
There's been clear relief among health service managers at news that strikes are off the agenda as winter approaches. NHS providers representing trusts in England said it was great news after a dispute which was disruptive, divisive and costly. Patients will be relieved too. More than 1.5 million appointments and operations have been cancelled because of action by all health unions in England since the end of 2022. Wes Streeting said the dispute should never have been allowed to get to that state and he'd negotiated an end to strikes in just 3 weeks of talks. The BMA said it was thanking members who'd stood on picket lines and fought for their worth, but the campaign was not over, and it still had a long way to go to achieve its aims on doctors' pay. Another clash with the government over pay has not been ruled out.
A report has highlighted serious concerns about the number of people off work because of long-term illness, describing Britain as the sick man of Europe. The think tank, the Institute for Public Policy Research, said the health challenges facing the UK had reached historic proportions and warned the situation was on track to get even worse. Researchers have set out a series of recommendations focused on preventing illness rather than treating it. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes has been looking at the study.
Having diagnosed the serious problems the NHS faces in his review last week, Lord Darzi is now offering solutions in this report. A key issue is the high number of people off work due to long-term sickness. The report says this could reach well over 4 million by the end of the next Parliament. This not only increases the pressure on the NHS, but affects economic productivity and tax revenues. The authors suggest moving from policies based on treating sickness to ones of creating better health. They propose increasing taxes on tobacco, alcohol and unhealthy foods, offering universal free school meals, restoring funding for the Sure Start programme for the under fives, establishing neighbourhood health centres and offering those off sick what they call the right to try work with no risk to existing health or disability benefits. The report's authors say adopting a health creation model could potentially add 10 years to healthy life expectancy within three decades.
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, is expected to criticise the government for what he'll call its doom and gloom when he closes his party's annual conference in Brighton later. He'll also attack the Conservatives, saying they were unfit to govern and are unfit for opposition too. Sir Ed will claim his party offers hope instead. Donald Trump has spoken publicly for the first time since he was targeted in an apparent assassination attempt at his golf course in Florida. Investigators say the suspect hid in bushes for nearly 12 hours before he was spotted by Secret Service agents who fired at him. He fled and was later arrested. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is in West Palm Beach and sent this report.
Carrying on with his planned schedule despite Sunday's apparent assassination attempt, Donald Trump joined a cryptocurrency personality, Farouk Sarmad, for an online conversation. He described enjoying a round of golf with a friend when they heard shots fired. Mr. Trump said he wasn't sure if it was gunfire, but the Secret Service knew immediately it was bullets and they grabbed him. He praised the agents for doing an excellent job and said he hoped the suspect remained behind bars for a long time. He also talked about a phone call with President Biden.
He was very nice today. He called up to make sure I was okay, to make sure that, do I have any suggestions or anything? Mm-hmm. We do need more people on my detail because we have 50, 60,000 people showing up to events. You know, other people don't have that. But he couldn't have been nicer.
The acting head of the Secret Service told a news conference earlier that the footprint of Mr. Trump's security detail was now almost the same as it was when he was president, as Joe Biden had ordered extra resources to be assigned to him after the shooting in Pennsylvania 2 months ago. Donald Trump said that both of the men who appear to have attempted to kill him were radical leftists and claimed Democrats were using incendiary language about him that was inspiring people to try to kill him.
The head of the World Health Organization has described the situation in Sudan as very alarming. Thousands of people have died in the country since a civil war broke out in April last year between the army and the paramilitary RSF. In an interview for this programme, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said nearly half of Sudan's population of 25 million people had fled their homes and starvation was almost everywhere. He said the conflict was not getting the attention it deserved from the international community and suggested that race could be a factor.
I think race is in the play here. That's what I feel now, because we see the pattern now. And the situation in the camps is really, really tragic. So where is humanity, you would ask? You know, of course there is some support, but it's so limited. It's a token.
You can hear the full interview just after 7:30. The mayor of a town in southwestern Poland has told 40,000 residents to head for higher ground as the River Kwatska threatens to burst its banks. Several countries across Central and Eastern Europe are facing severe flooding caused by Storm Boris. At least 18 people have died. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford is in the Polish town of Nysa.
In Nysa, volunteers have been forming human chains to get sandbags to the riverbank and try to stop its collapse. The mayor has warned local residents to evacuate to higher ground, because if the river bursts its banks, the whole town could flood. Not far from here, a dam has already failed, increasing the pressure. Many homes have no running water and no power, and in towns where the floods have already receded, they've left filth and destruction behind them. Homes filled with mud, roads washed away, cars upturned, and trees uprooted.
The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, is to warn that crises in climate and nature are the defining challenges of our times. In his first major speech later today, he will announce plans to build an alliance of countries to accelerate the transition to clean energy. A controversial proposal to build a holiday resort on the banks of Loch Lomond was rejected last night by the National Park Authority. The theme park operator Flamingo Land had wanted the development at Balloch in West Dunbartonshire to include a monorail, water park and restaurants, but the plan sparked huge local opposition, with more than 170,000 people objecting.
Thank you. 9 minutes past seven is the time. The threat of strike action by junior doctors in England has been lifted, at least for the time being, though they say their campaign has not ended. Let us talk to Dr. Vivek Trivedi, who is the co-chair of the Junior Doctors Committee of the BMA and is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. Wes Streeting, Health Secretary for England, saying this is a fair settlement, a fair compromise. Is that how you would characterise it?
Well, it marks what could be the first step towards our goal, which, as you've referenced, has been unchanged, and that's to restore the pay, because it restores the value of being a doctor here. We've had successive pay cuts since 2008, but finally this could mark that. Well, it does. It has turned the tide on pay cuts, but we're still, even with this offer, which we hear a lot about it being 22%, but that's not what doctors were voting on. We were voting on a 4.05% offer, and with that and the uplifts already established around that, we would still be 20% behind compared to 2008.
Right. So in those terms, is it a fair settlement and a fair compromise?
Well, that's exactly what it is. It is a compromise. And as you'll have seen from our voting numbers, there's still many doctors who said that this did not go far enough.
Yes, that's interesting, including quite a few who've taken to social media. I'm just looking at a couple of tweets or X's or whatever we call them now. Feeling pretty betrayed by the BMA this evening. It's been pretty clear the deal nowhere near good enough. Further strikes are going to be needed to reach full pay restoration, one says. Another says one can only hope the bank and build approach works. Future committees and negotiations prove us wrong. Are there going to be future strikes?
There doesn't have to be any future strikes. So Mr. Streeting has talked about our pay falling behind inflation and has talked about a journey to fair pay and sees that journey occurring via the independent pay review bodies awarding their regular annual uplifts. And he wants to restore confidence in that process, which doctors don't have for a number of reasons. But if that process does play out the way he envisages, the way that maybe it used to in the past, and that does inspire the confidence of doctors, then of course there's no reason for doctors to go back into dispute over pay and strike again. But if that doesn't happen and the government does not correct that and does not continue our journey to full pay restoration, which is what doctors have been calling for, to keep their colleagues here so that medicine can remain an attractive profession in this country, then the government will find doctors back in dispute, because that's ultimately what we're trying to keep hold of, our colleagues staying here.
Your colleague, Rob Lawrenson, had a set of WhatsApps, didn't he, that were leaked, I think, back in the summer. I would consider striking with a low threshold for 2025-26, he said in one of them, when Labour's honeymoon period ends and they make some sort of mistake that leaves them politically vulnerable. Do you still stand by what he said in that message?
I think what he's trying to say is that we have to assess what's happening, and we don't want to have to strike. But if the government performs in the same way as previous governments have, in dangling something at the beginning but then rowing back on promises, then that's, of course, going to further damage the relationship that doctors have with the government.
Right. So, I mean, to be clear, the threat of strike action, and he said this in one of his messages, didn't he? Strike action will work again in the future. That threat is still very much there.
That threat will always be there, but it doesn't ever have to be there, because if two parties could have had a reasonable conversation from the start, as many other industries do, as many other professions can manage, then strikes don't ever have to occur. They're a last resort when communications, unfortunately, break down.
How confident are you, then, that Wes Streeting sees things the same way as you and that your future negotiations with him will be fruitful?
That's unfortunately something that I can't predict, and only time will tell.
But you obviously have a relationship with him, and you know the cut of his jib, as it were. You know what he wants to achieve, particularly when it comes to greater productivity within the NHS. I mean, do you kind of sense that he is someone you can do business with in a productive way without the need even to threaten strikes?
I take everybody at face value, and I don't think there's not a great deal of benefit in trying to guess what people's true motives are. And so we'll approach every meeting that we have with Mr. Streeting or whoever it may be with an open mind and in good faith, as we did even with the previous government. But unfortunately, actions are what speaks louder than words. And so if we are able to deliver what doctors have been calling for, to restore value, to keep their colleagues here so that they feel that medicine is a viable profession and we can build the health service back to what it was, then we don't ever have to go back into dispute. But if it does seem to be that they are just words and the actions are not following through, then that is when the government will find doctors back in dispute. Because this puts a doctor who was before this earning £15 an hour only on £17 an hour, which of course is an improvement, and it does mark the start of that journey, but the journey's not over.
Dr. Vivek Trivedi, thank you very much.
7:15 is the time. Tuition fees need to go up, as does government funding of universities. That suggestion seems clear when you look at proposals and key asks seen by this programme that have come from Universities UK, the body which represents more than 140 such institutions. In England, the £9,250 annual fees have not risen for the last 7 years. And the issue of university education, what it's for and whether it's worth it, was raised with us by listeners when we asked earlier this year what you wanted us to dig into. And so here we are. We'll hear from some of those listeners, young people and their parents, in a report in an hour's time. And with us now is Professor Dame Sally Mapstone, who's Vice-Chancellor of the University of St Andrews and also the current Principal of Universities UK. Good morning, Professor Mapstone.
Morning.
What do you think university fees should be today?
So what we're looking for from the new government is the opportunity for a reset and the opportunity to look right across the funding arrangements for fees and for students. As you've indicated, the major problem with university finance is that for the past 8 to 9 years, direct government grants and fees haven't kept up with the cost of teaching and with inflation. So more and more institutions are facing a budget deficit overall. We think that there needs to be a good dialogue with government in partnership about the relationship between the direct teaching grant that government can provide and the fees that students pay. We are alert to the fact, of course, that when you say fees should go up, people are alarmed at the consequences for students, which is why we also think that it's very important that the support that students get in terms of maintenance loans and grants also be looked at.
In increasing the amount they can borrow and also reinstating grants for students from disadvantaged backgrounds, I see that that's also in your proposals.
It is, because we feel very much that our proposals are really focused on opportunity, on growth and partnership. And opportunity should be for everybody from whatever background who has the potential to do well at university to benefit from that experience. Those from the most disadvantaged background should have the opportunity to receive maintenance grants. And there should also be a good look at the current maintenance loan system.
Okay, but under your proposals, essentially students would have to borrow more, wouldn't they? Because any reinstation of grants would only apply to the poorest. There'd be many others who wouldn't get a maintenance grant. So they'd be able to borrow more for maintenance and they would have to be further in loan for tuition fees. Would you acknowledge that it is poorer students who are much more put off by the prospect of even greater debt affecting their lives?
So, of course, it's the case that when you're looking at going to university, you've got to make a lot of calculations. It undoubtedly is the case that if you learn more, you earn more. And you have to look at the benefit of university education across a lifetime. There is very good evidence that if you go to university in your 20s and in your 30s, you will be earning more than if you didn't. So it's really important that students look at the prospect of university education in terms of the benefit that it brings across a lifetime. But let's also, I would like really to emphasise that although the £12,000 to £13,000 figure is very much within our proposals, we are not saying that fees should go up to £12,000 or £13,000. That's essentially the cost that if teaching costs had kept pace with inflation and what it costs to teach a student would have been reached. But we feel that government needs to look at the public benefit as well as the private benefit that actually comes from education and should look at the teaching grant as another means of achieving this research.
You say that if you learn more, you earn more, but currently, all university tuition fees are the same across universities, aren't they? At least for, you know, that's the case across England. It'll be the case for students from the rest of the UK coming to your university in Scotland. Whereas we know, don't we, that the value of some degrees is much more than the value of others. Why should you be paying the same for an Oxbridge degree versus other universities in the Russell Group or universities outside?
Well, for a start, I don't think that we should consider a straight trade-off between the Russell Group or Oxbridge and other universities. If we look at non-Russell Group universities, they are training about 90% of our teachers, people working in nursing and so forth, all occupations which are really essential to the new government's plans for growth and the extension of the skills market. So this should not be seen as some kind of arms race. We have regulation which ensures that universities are held to account for the quality and the value of the degrees that they produce. So I don't think we should be looking at this as Oxbridge or the Russell Group.
Okay, but you think a flat rate is the right way to do it?
Well, I think we have to work with the system that we have at the moment. What we don't want to see is a long period of time in which we have another review of the whole system.
But it was never envisaged, was it, as a flat rate system? It was envisaged as a gradation, and actually all universities went up to the maximum.
Yes, but if you look at the situation now, it is very clear that right across the sector, as you indicated at the start of your remarks, the cost of teaching and all the associated things that go with this, career support, mental health support, libraries, sports, etc., is not covered by what is received from tuition fees and from direct grant.
Professor Sally Mapstone, thanks very much.
20 past seven is the time. A question mark remains over the future of the shipbuilder Harland & Wolff and its staff after it announced its holding company would go into administration. Sean is back with more on that.
Yeah, this is the shipyard, Justin, that built the Titanic, those famous yellow cranes over Belfast. Harland & Wolff declared that holding company, the owners of that underlying business, to be insolvent yesterday after repeated difficulties in raising money to back the company. Well over 1,000 people employed across various sites around the UK, including hundreds in Scotland, building infrastructure for the energy sector as well. Russell Downs joins me, Harland & Wolff's interim executive chairman, who joined the company in July after its chief executive then, John Wood, resigned. Russell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Sean.
Of the core parts of the business that I've described there, what is most at risk at the moment?
We need a future, we need to secure our future. So I think it's important to identify that all of the yards have a strong and capable business plan that will see them flourish and return. They all have work ongoing at the moment, but we need to come through the financial difficulties we've got to move the business into new ownership. That's the critical thing we need to protect.
So just to be clear, how many jobs are at risk at the moment when you look at the numbers?
We've got about 1,300 people turning up for work day in, day out at the moment.
And given what you know of potential buyers, is it more likely the business will be broken up and sold in parts now or sold in its entirety?
I think there's a strong case for keeping the 4 yards together. I think that actually is sensible from an operating perspective. I can't prejudge what ultimately the bidders will want, but there is still some chance, of course, that some yards might be owned by one owner, but other yards might be owned by another. So we'll just have to see where that process gets to.
When you see some of the bidders potentially on the table, do you recognise that some of them might only want parts of the business?
We've got a number of interested parties, and some of them are looking for the business as a whole, including our gas storage facility just outside of Belfast as well. Others are more specific about what they're interested. We'll just have to see what the offers come in at and make a decision at that point.
Is the UK government doing enough at the moment?
We're in obviously regular contact with them. At the moment, we're not asking for any support. I think they've made their position clear around enabling us to work through a market solution. Of course, they're interested, as indeed all stakeholders are, to ensure that the future of the business and the yards in particular, you know, move into new ownership and flourish in that new world.
You've appointed lawyers to investigate how £25 million or so of funds were spent previously at the business. What concerns do you have there?
I think that, you know, a key part of business is around maintaining trust and confidence. And we've seen that in of course, many other situations. For me, certain things happened that made me question the trust and confidence here. And I thought it was right and appropriate to establish what the facts are. And then that will enable the business to move forward. So at the moment, we're doing fact finding. We need to understand what's happened, and then we can find a way forward from there. So, yes, I've brought in independent law firm and financial advisors to help us assess what has actually happened.
And just to put, you know, always describe Harlander Wolf as iconic and referring back to the Titanic, but to put into a bit of perspective what is on the line here, feels like a major moment for the future of what is done in Belfast, that what Harlander Wolf means for the UK economy.
It really is. I think it's important for UK as a whole in the context of a shipbuilding strategy, but more importantly than that, the business breaks down into 4 yards. We've got Arnish up near Stornoway. We've got another one just east of Edinburgh. Then we've got one in Devon. And, of course, you know, the Belfast yard. Each of those serve different customers. Each of those are really significant within their communities. And so there is an awful lot on the line. But I am confident that we can overcome our financial difficulties to make sure that the businesses do return to the form and can deliver the legacy that we all hope them to.
Russell Downs, Executive Chairman of Harlander Wolf, thank you very much.
Sean, thank you. 25 past seven. What does Elon Musk bring to politics? His supporters say freedom is what he brings, freedom to say what you want. But his Twitter or X platform does cooperate with governments to censor some content. And the man himself is now a firm supporter of Donald Trump. Kate Conger is a tech journalist for The New York Times, who's co-written a book about Twitter called Character Limit. She told me what Elon Musk's power is.
Elon Musk has always really been drawn to the power of Twitter as a political platform. And he's used it at first to sort of build political capital for Tesla and some of his other companies, and then expanded that vision and started seeing ways he could use the platform to influence the conversation about elections in the United States. We've seen that pick up particularly in the last several months.
How does he use it in the US?
He started tweeting negatively about President Biden in 2021, suggesting he was a puppet of the unions and that he was excluding Musk from an electrical vehicle summit. He's also used the platform, of course, to endorse former President Donald Trump and invited Trump on to speak on X Spaces. Trump just used that platform tonight to announce a cryptocurrency venture. So he's really wedded the platform to the Trump campaign.
And of course, there is the prospect, isn't there, of considerable money flowing from Musk to Trump.
Yes, Musk has said that he will be a donor to the Trump campaign. And, you know, Trump has sort of repaid that with an offer to give Musk a position in the administration.
Yeah, which itself is odd, isn't it? Because Musk is someone who has business to do with the US government. And to put it mildly, it might be a conflict of interest, mightn't it, if he ever actually took up that post?
Exactly. SpaceX, his rocket company, receives billions of dollars in contracts from the US government. There's great potential for conflict of interest as well on the AI front. You know, as a new administration make policy on AI, Musk is running XAI.
And against all that, Elon Musk himself, if he were here, would say, look, it's freedom. I own the thing. I can say what I like on it. And indeed, it's much freer as a platform than it used to be, where certain things were censored.
Twitter, under its former management, did a lot of studies on how to get more people using the platform. And the problem with the content moderation strategy that Musk is pursuing is that it elevates very loud voices like his own, but it drives away smaller users.
The issue is, though, that even if that is true, there were things that were not able to be said on Twitter. Things, for instance, about COVID and its origins, things about Hunter Biden, the president's son, and his laptop. And there were all sorts of areas where freedom of speech was suppressed, and actually the truth was suppressed as well.
It's an incredibly difficult social challenge to run this company. And in our book, we go through the three different CEOs who have taken a crack at this, and all of them have really struggled with the challenges of content moderation. People get uncomfortable when they have to be the sole arbiter of truth and what can be shared online.
Is the US government going to get involved eventually?
There's not a particularly strong regulatory push against X or other social media companies in the United States right now. But I think the company faces more regulatory pressure in the EU. And then, of course, the platform was recently banned in Brazil altogether for not complying with content moderation requirements. So I think the pressure from governments is more likely to come from overseas than from within the United States itself.
Kate Conger, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up to 7:30, Cathy has the sport.
Morning, thank you very much. The Champions League returns tonight with a new format involving more clubs and one single table. Manchester City, Arsenal, Liverpool, Aston Villa and Celtic are all involved in the prestigious European club competition over the next three nights. The Aston Villa manager, Unai Emery, wants his side to win their opening Champions League game tonight against Young Boys in memory of the club's European Cup winner, Gary Shaw, who died yesterday at the age of 63. Shaw was in the Aston Villa team that won the competition in 1982. Tonight's game is Villa's first in Europe's top tier competition in 41 years. And there's commentary of that game on Five Live from 5:45. Lord Coe, currently president of World Athletics, has been named as one of seven confirmed candidates to succeed Thomas Bach as the president of the International Olympic Committee, while the Scottish Government is on the verge of agreeing a deal for Glasgow to host the 2026 Commonwealth Games, with an announcement expected today. What difference does hosting a major sports event make to a nation? With tomorrow being National Fitness Day, let's speak to the CEO of UK Active, Hugh Edwards, who also previously worked with the LTA and the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. Hugh, legacy is a word used constantly when an Olympics, a Commonwealth Games, a Euros, whatever event it is held in Great Britain. But from your experience being part of the Olympic Delivery Authority for London, is there really a positive impact on health?
I think it's fundamentally a clarity of what legacy you seek, Cathy, really. I think I worked for 6 years in London 2012, and at the heart of that project was regeneration and a generational transformation of that part of East London. What you can do, and subject to what happens with Glasgow, is probably twofold. How do you work with the sport and physical activity sector in strengthening the fabric of communities, addressing disconnection and isolation, what the sector can do, and also use the sector as a catalyst for health change? So looking at the biggest drivers, which are walking, swimming, running, cycling and fitness.
And those are activities that you don't really need to go anywhere to do, as in go to a gym or a leisure centre. But see, your CEO of UK Active, which works with those departments, they have had a tough time over the last few years. So what are your main concerns at the moment?
I think it's around driving growth and demand for services, Cathy. The NHS is in a critical condition and we need to stop people using the NHS at the rate it does. And sport and physical activity in these facilities have a key role to play in that. We have a national health crisis with record levels of long-term sick and people on waiting lists. And so the opportunity for the government now is to work with gym, sports and leisure centres and place physical activity at the centre of the prevention first health system. Industry leaders across the whole of the sector has called for the UK to be the most active nation in Europe. And at the heart of that needs to be a long-term robust plan for children and young people to make them the happiest and healthiest they can be, to back these facilities to support physical activity, and then to fully integrate the sector into the work of the NHS, especially around mental health and musculoskeletal issues.
Yeah, we're discussing some of that later in the programme, actually. And there is an impact also from seeing Olympic athletes. The Olympic weightlifting medalist Emily Campbell is involved in your National Fitness Day, particularly as she's someone who's talked a lot about body confidence, which is part of the mental health situation you're talking about.
Absolutely. You know, we've got Emily and Maisie Newton-Summers tomorrow on National Fitness Day down at the Aquatic Centre on the Olympic Park, but with hundreds of events taking place across the country. And there's a real opportunity for, you know, these incredible ambassadors and role models coming from Paris to really support our work around how we make the sector as inclusive it can be within the communities they operate in. And so there'll be events across schools, businesses, hospitals, community halls, sports clubs and gyms, sports and leisure centres as well, really celebrating the importance of physical activity for our physical, mental and social well-being.
Yeah, you're the CEO of UK Active, thank you. And as mentioned, we will be discussing the 2026 Commonwealth Games possible move to Glasgow in the next hour with Michael Kavanagh, the former chairman of Commonwealth Games Scotland.
Cathy, thanks. This weekend there'll be comedy for an unusual character.
Dear BBC, when, oh when, will you stop providing a platform to puppets?
There's someone or something new coming to Saturday nights.
Hi, I'm Randy Feldface, a purple puppet from Australia who somehow managed to get a show on Radio 4.
If you've never seen me before, Google Satanic Spawn of Barney the Dinosaur and you'll get the general idea.
He's made entirely of felt and he wants to destroy the world.
The point is, the planet is getting hotter. We're on track for mass extinction and I want to see it happen.
Randy Feltface's Destruction Manual
begins this Saturday night at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The weather today, it is expected to become largely dry and settled after showers in the far north diminish.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Michelle Hussain and Justin Webb. It's nearly 25 to 8. Jane Steele has the news.
Universities in England are to tell the government tuition fees need to be increased in line with inflation to help prevent them from sliding into decline. These fees have been frozen for 7 years and around 40% of universities are expecting to return a budget deficit this year. The Health Secretary Wes Streeting has said the end of a pay dispute by junior doctors in England marks the first step in the government's mission to make the NHS fit for the future. Members of the British Medical Association voted to accept a 22% pay rise over 2 years. But Dr. Vivek Trivedi from the BMA told us that if the new government were to row back on its promises, junior doctors would be prepared to strike again. Britain has been described as the sick man of Europe in a report highlighting serious concerns about the number of people off work due to long-term illness. Researchers from the think tank the Institute for Public Policy Research have set out a series of recommendations focused on preventing illness rather than treating it. The Liberal Democrat leader Sir Ed Davey is expected to criticise the government for what he will call its doom and gloom when he closes his party's annual conference in Brighton later. Sir Ed will claim his party offers hope instead. Donald Trump has spoken publicly for the first time since a suspected assassination attempt at his golf course in Florida. In a live stream on social media, he praised his protection team and commended President Biden for his response, saying he couldn't have been nicer. A study has shown the export of British goods continues to be hit by post-Brexit trade restrictions. Economists at Aston University in Birmingham have carried out a comprehensive analysis of trade data from the 3 years since the UK left the EU. They found that agri-food, textiles and the wood and paper trades have been most affected. This year's Booker Prize shortlist will feature the biggest number of women authors in its 55-year history. Five women and one man will be put forward for the prestigious literary prize.
Jane, thank you very much. It is 25 to 8. Peace is the best medicine, the head of the World Health Organization has told us, speaking in a rare interview about the health crises he is seeing that are caused by war, as well as about Mpox, the virus that has caused hundreds of deaths this year in Central Africa. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus spoke to us from Adre in Chad, which is right on the border with Sudan. It was after a trip he had made into Sudan to see the impact of more than a year of civil war, with the army on one side and a paramilitary force on the other.
Situation in Sudan is very, very alarming. You know about the massive displacement. It's now the largest in the world. And of course, famine. Imagine destruction, displacement, and now famine. That's so tragic. When I was in Sudan, actually, I visited a camp for IDPs. And also, I have visited a hospital. And you see there many children, skin and bone, emaciated. And you can see also famine is in restricted areas like Al-Fasha and so on. But starvation is almost everywhere. So the scale is really big. And as you know, half of the population needs support now, which is close to 25 million of the total population. And that's really big. And 12 million of the population is already displaced. 10 million internally and more than 2 million who fled the country. So it's really tragic. And the attention it gets from the international community is really low. It's not getting the attention it deserves. And I have seen it all, and I will continue to speak about it. I think Sudan deserves to be the center of attention.
Why do you think it isn't?
That's the sad part, because you see it repeatedly. It's not just Sudan, but you see it in other areas. You remember when there was war in Tigray, Ethiopia, I made the same comment. It was a very tragic war. The number of people killed is even more than what you see now in Sudan. And the level of rape was in tens of thousands. My observation is when it comes to South, especially in Africa, and I think the attention is really, really low.
Is race a factor in that? And I ask that because I think you did some time ago say that you wondered whether the world gives equal attention to black and white lives. And you were thinking on the one hand about Ethiopia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Syria, and you were contrasting that with concern for Ukraine.
Exactly. I think race is in the play here. That's what I feel now, because we see the pattern now. It's a pattern. And, you know, today I was on the border, Adre, and we actually dispatched convoys from Adre to Darfur. And I have visited some camps there. And I met mothers who told me that they have worked actually for 18 days with children. And the camps we have visited, more than 94% are women and children. So where is humanity, you would ask? You know, of course, there is some support, but it's so limited. It's a token compared to the magnitude. I think it's nothing. So that's what I worry now. Is it really a race issue that nobody gives attention and you see tragedy? I think we have to see this and understand it.
And money and funding flows from attention, doesn't it? I wonder how much funding the projects that you as WHO or the work that you want to carry out in Sudan, how much funding you have for those? Is there a shortfall?
Yeah, funding is an issue, because if you take, for instance, the level of funding for the crisis in Sudan, it's very small compared to the need. So it's with increased attention, then you can have more finance as well. So when I say international community, it's governments, it's donors, but at the same time, it's also media and the mainstream media, I think, should give it more attention because it's really a tragedy.
Were you shocked by what you saw in Sudan? Because I feel listening to you that you were, and yet I know that you must have seen many terrible things, not only in your time leading the WHO, but before that.
Yeah, before that, because I know war.
You grew up as a child during war?
Yes. So I was brought up actually in the middle of war, and I know the smell of war, the image of war, the sound of war.
And its impact? on you? That's Ethiopia you're referring to.
Yeah, the impact on me, but from that I can understand how it impacts others. And I remember my mother actually praying that I survive a day at a time. So, you know, growing up, survival of a day was a big deal. And I see the same thing now in Sudan. I see the same thing in Gaza. A very tragic situation, and, you know, communities trapped, and women and children paying the lion's share. And although their children and women are the victims, but they have nothing to do with the war. And I see it from childhood, and I see it now. And that's why I can relate easily, because I can understand what it means.
What is your biggest concern in relation to health in Gaza? I know there are many competing realities, very stark realities, but which one worries you the most?
In Gaza, of course, you know, the health system has already collapsed. Out of the 36 hospitals, only 17 are functioning, actually partially functioning. And you remember recently the detection of polio. Of course, there was a successful campaign, first round. Around 560,000 kids under 10 have been vaccinated. That's welcome. But to be honest, you know, the best medicine is peace. The best vaccine is peace. For instance, a child has been vaccinated today. If the same child is killed in a shelling tomorrow, so what's the point? You would ask that. And you give food to children or those who are under siege there, and they survive a few days, to die a few days after is really tragic. So that's why we call for ceasefire.
You must be watching all the data on Mpox very closely. And since the beginning of the year, there have been more than 13,000 cases and 450 deaths in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It has spread to other countries, including Burundi, the Central African Republic, Kenya and Rwanda. Do you think it is going to spread beyond Central and East Africa in a considerable way?
I think it's in our hands. We have the tools, and I believe that we can contain it within the countries that are reporting now. But one thing I would like to stress here is the cost or the price of the vaccines is very, very high. For instance, for a course, which is two doses for one person, means it's around $270. Imagine if you're going to vaccinate 1 million, it's 270 million. If you are going to vaccinate 10 million, you can just multiply and see how big it is just for vaccines alone. So I hope the international community will help in making the price of the vaccine as reasonable as possible. You know, many are worried about, you know, okay, will there be lockdowns and so on? No, there will not be lockdowns. I think we can manage and stop this. And I would like to say that with all the measures that are at hand and with the coordination I see now, I think it can be stopped as soon as possible.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the WHO, thank you very much. And the time is now 7:45. There is a court case underway in Reno, Nevada, about the rights of Rupert Murdoch's children over how his businesses operate after his death. It was never supposed to become public, at least not as far as the 93-year-old father of six was concerned. However, some details have been revealed by the New York Times, and it is being seen as a real-life legal version of TV's Succession, because three of the four eldest children are trying to maintain voting shares and power. Claire Atkinson is here in the studio. She's a journalist who spent years writing about Rupert Murdoch, and her biography, Murdoch, is due to be released next year. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning.
First of all, what was the change that Rupert Murdoch was seeking to make?
So Rupert wants to make sure that his eldest son, Lachlan Murdoch, who is currently the CEO of Fox, maintains control over the companies that he currently has voting control over. So that would be Fox and also News Corporation, which owns the Wall Street Journal, the Sun newspaper, the Australian. It's got some other assets too. And so Rupert had been hearing word that some of the siblings, Liz Murdoch, James and Prudence, were not necessarily on the same page as Lachlan politically, and that they perhaps wanted to make changes. And so this is Rupert really saying that once I pass, I want Lachlan to be in control of the company. His politics, obviously, are very important to him. Conservative politics have shown through Fox News and in the Wall Street Journal's opinion columns. And so Rupert is really saying, I want Lachlan to maintain my views and to keep control of the companies so that we don't have a situation where the siblings have differing views about how management should operate.
And this is a private case, isn't it? How do we know anything about it at all?
Yes, we only know anything about the fact that this irrevocable trust is that Rupert's making an attempted change because documents were leaked to the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. Perhaps one of the children decided to make it public that way and perhaps put pressure on the parties to come together. There are settlement talks going on right now. The parties are all in Reno, Nevada this week. It's unusual to see them all together except for weddings. And so this is quite an unusual situation where we're seeing this irrevocable trust be contested.
Well, and can it be? Because the word irrevocable does rather suggest that it can't.
Yes, I think Rupert and the parties are trying to argue that it's in the financial interests of all children to maintain Lachlan's management of the company, because if they watered down Fox News, for instance, maybe it wouldn't make as much money. And so that's the argument, that it's in the good of all parties for Lachlan to maintain control.
What do you think it tells us about the family and about Rupert Murdoch himself at the age of 93?
Well, I think this goes back to how he took over the company that his father, Keith Murdoch, had wanted him to inherit. Keith had taken stakes in all these different little papers in Australia, had hoped to give Rupert an inheritance. And what happened was he died unexpectedly, and Rupert, at the age of 21, saw all these newspaper stakes be taken by Keith Murdoch's partners. And so I'm sure in his mind he's thinking he wouldn't want something similar to happen to his children, and he would want things to be organized for them.
Do you think he'll get his way?
I think Rupert always gets his way, but then this is in the hands of this judge in Nevada, and so we'll see what happens.
Claire Atkinson, thanks very much.
12 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Professor Mona Siddiqui, the broadcaster and academic at the University of Edinburgh.
Good morning. When I was at university, one of my professors told me that when he retired, he would retire in Sicily. He said, "It's such a beautiful and magical part of the world." And last week, I was lucky enough to discover this for myself. The capital, Palermo, a city which Oscar Wilde described as the most beautifully situated town in the world, which dreams away its life. And the stunning hilltop town of Taormina, sitting in the shadow of Mount Etna, the tallest active volcano in Europe. Mount Etna has erupted frequently, and over the centuries, its hot ashes have caused some disruption to the nearby towns and cities. So I expected people living there to be anxious. But I was to discover that instead people have adapted to the risk, respecting the volcano and nature more widely. The nourishing lava ash has created a fertile land, perfect for cultivating everything, from rich citrus fruits and olive trees to craft industries made possible with lava stone. On returning home, I was greeted with the news that at least 8 people had died, many more were missing, and thousands of homes had been destroyed in floods sweeping through central Europe. I thought of the difference between the newer man-made environmental threats and the age-old risk of volcanic eruptions. The concern is that global heating now means it isn't possible for millions of people to adapt or live safely in their environment. The dramatic climate shifts could lead to a new kind of physical and cultural dislocation. But I think this very crisis also offers us an opportunity to think not only in terms of what we are destroying, but of the kind of world we can now create. In the Quranic story of the creation of Adam, the angels ask God, "Why have you created a being who will only shed blood and cause destruction in the world. We are here to worship you. God's reply was, I know what you don't. God's knowledge remains his alone. But I do think the angels had a point. Human beings do destroy and shed blood. We often harm our personal, cultural and natural environment through careless, selfish, short-term, even violent behaviours. But this story tells me that we were also made for something more than worship alone. We love, we create, we dream, we imagine new worlds. With the devastation caused by floods and droughts, we now have a chance to enlarge our moral imagination, to create a society where everyone has a chance to live in safety and in hope.
That was Thought for the Day with Professor Mona Siddiqui. The time is 8:08.
We are sick. Britain is sick. We are, according to the Institute for Public Policy Research, sicker than our competitors in Europe, sick in proportions that are historic. But the report also highlights solutions. It's not simply a moan about our national condition, although the solutions are some of them costly and some of them deeply offensive to those who complain that the state should stay out of our private health decisions and choices. Let us talk to Dame Sally Davis, who is co-chair of the Commission on Health and Prosperity, as it is called, and is also, of course, the former UK Chief Medical Advisor. Good morning to you, Dame Sally.
Good morning, Justin.
Take the nanny state stuff head on, first of all. To those who say this is nanny statism, you say what?
Well, I don't think there's anything that constrains people's freedoms more than sickness that could have been avoided, treated, or otherwise better managed. And you only have to look at how the advertising is and how tasty and delicious some of these unhealthy foods and drinks and life issues are for us to understand why in that flood of activity, we all have a risk of overeating, under-exercising, being in polluted places. So if we can't do it on our own, and the data is clear, more than 900,000 people are out of work because of ill health at the moment. And that, if you look at the trends, will go up by 1.5 million in this parliament, costing us within 10 years at least 18 billion a year in the NHS. Let alone looking at the personal costs, then we have to do something. And the libertarians and the people who talk about freedoms don't understand the evidence and don't choose to look at the imbalance in advertising and activity. I don't want anyone's freedom trammelling. They should be able, I want to be able, to eat nice food and drink. But I also want good food, healthy food to be available, and I want people to be a healthy weight. Yeah. Normal weight in this country is no longer healthy.
Right, so to get that weight down, what kind of taxation, because presumably that's what we're talking about, of, for instance, ultra-processed foods, are we talking about? What difference from the cost at the moment to the cost that should be there?
I have not modelled that, but look at the example of the sugary drinks levy, and what you can see is companies reformulated, and then actually their profits went up because they sold more. So it isn't just a one-sided game, this. We could, by pushing this forward, have companies that sell all around the world, because we may be the sickest of Europe, but plenty of other countries want healthier, lower calorie, less processed food. Mm-hmm.
You're also calling for government action, and you make some forays into what is certainly the area of hot political potatoes at the moment. We recommend the two-child limit is abolished alongside the benefit cap, and you have a cost for that as well. Why is that so important to you as a commission?
Well, the commission is 20 commissioners and IPPR, and we've had deep conversations, and we all across this country are worried about poverty and the bad start that children in low-income and middle-income families are getting, and it's aggravated by this two-child policy. I also, and the commission puts it forward, think we should move at least in primary school and ideally all the way through to free school meals. And yes, It does cost. But this is, both of these are investments in our future. If we get it right for children, then 70, 80 years later, it will still be paying back.
Do you think the government is, do you think the government accepts, behind the scenes at least, your case, even if they're worried about the money side of it? Do they accept the fundamental case that you're making?
The Labour Party, last time they were in, absolutely accepted this, and this government is engaging with all these ideas because we need a healthy workforce. We need to reduce the demand on the NHS, and we want people to be happy. And, you know, overweight and obese people have a much higher incidence of mental health problems.
A final thought then. How quickly can this happen? Because I think we always assume with reports like this, number one, that they get just put on a shelf and left, but number two, that actually everything's rather long term. Are you saying we could make a real difference really quickly?
We could start to make a difference within 5 years, but it'll take 10 years. So this is the type of agenda that if a party is prepared to be bold, they should do early in their time in Parliament so they get the benefit as well as the nation and all of us as individuals.
Right. Strong hint there. Dame Sally Davis, thank you very much.
Let us turn to the weather, which is with Helen Willetts. Morning, Helen.
Morning, Michelle. Hello there. High pressure will continue to dominate for, well, much of this week. The risk of showers does increase later on from the south. But let's enjoy some sunshine, if that's what you like. It's been a bit chilly this morning as we start in England and Wales, down to 2 or 3 degrees. But temperatures will respond to still fairly strong sunshine at this time of year, getting up to between 18 and 21 degrees. That's with a little bit of mist through the Vale of York currently, the West Midlands, and stretching down towards the plains as well, the Salisbury Plain. That should clear away. Then it's plenty of sunshine. There's the outside chance of a shower for southeast, particularly Kent, and there's quite a brisk wind for the southeast along with East Anglia today, and that will temper the feeling a bit cooler than yesterday, I think. To Northern Ireland, where also with the high pressure, it means that fine and settled weather, a little bit of early morning mist, some patchy cloud around, but sunny spells certainly, and lighter winds. So temperatures here will also reach the high teens or the low 20s, as will many parts of Scotland after a chill start here too. The fly in the ointment is a weather front just sitting across the northern and west Niles, the northwest mainland, giving a little bit of rain this morning, but the rain's drying up, the cloud will lift as that weather front starts to pull away. But certainly the best of the sunshine will be for mainland Scotland, where temperatures around Moray Firth could get to 22 or 23 degrees Celsius, but under that cloud in the far north, probably more like 14 or 15.
Helen, thank you.
On BBC iPlayer.
I'm on a train. It's the Glasgow to London night sleeper service.
Brand new drama.
I think we may have a problem.
There's been a hack check-in. Hijacks are so 20th century.
We're being controlled remotely.
This train is now a guided missile.
One of the passengers may be working with the hackers. Don't trust anyone.
You're never getting off, are we?
Night Sleeper. Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
And coming up in the next hour of this programme, what's it all for and is it worth the money? We mean a university education. Listeners give us their perspective as the universities themselves ask to hike up fees for students and ask the government to give more as well. We will be discussing all of that at 10 past eight.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4, Michelle Hussain and Justin Webb. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 17th of September. The headlines this morning: universities in England are to tell the government they need to put up tuition fees to tackle growing financial problems. Junior doctors say their pay campaign is not over, despite voting to accept a new deal to end their long-running dispute. And a major review has said that the UK is the sick man of Europe when it comes to health and has proposed new taxes on alcohol, tobacco and junk food to prevent illness. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Universities in England say tuition fees need to be increased in line with inflation to help prevent them from sliding into decline. Proposals by the organisation Universities UK have been shared exclusively with this programme. They call for more government support for both institutions and students. More details from our education reporter, Vanessa Clark.
In proposals due to be released in the coming days, Universities UK will call for more investment from the government and students, the latter through an inflation-linked rise in tuition fees. The body, which represents more than 140 institutions, also wants maintenance grants to be increased and to ensure students have access to child and adolescent mental health services until they are 25. In England, tuition fees have been frozen at £9,250 for 7 years. The blueprint says universities are losing money teaching UK students. About 40% of universities are expecting to return a budget deficit this year. The Department for Education in England says it has inherited a challenging set of circumstances and it will create a secure future for universities.
The principal of Universities UK, Professor Dame Sally Mapstone, told us vice-chancellors were seeking the opportunity for a reset on the issue of funding.
We feel that government needs to look at the public benefit as well as the private benefit that actually comes from education. It is very clear that right across the sector, the cost of teaching and all the associated things that go with this, career support, mental health support, libraries, schools, etc., is not covered by what is received from tuition fees and from direct grant.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has said the end of a pay dispute involving junior doctors in England marks the necessary first step in the government's mission to make the NHS fit for the future. Members of the British Medical Association have voted to accept an offer of a 22% rise over 2 years. But the co-chair of the Junior Doctors Committee of the BMA, Dr. Vivek Trivedi, told us that future strike action couldn't be ruled out.
We'll approach every meeting that we have with Mr. Streeting or whoever it may be with an open mind and in good faith, as we did even with the previous government. But actions are what speaks louder than words. And so if we are able to deliver what doctors have been calling for, to restore value, to keep their colleagues here so that they feel that medicine is a viable profession and we can build the health service back to what it was, then we don't ever have to go back into dispute.
A report has highlighted serious concerns about the number of people off work because of long-term illness, describing Britain as the sick man of Europe. The think tank, the Institute for Public Policy Research, said the health challenges facing the UK had reached historic proportions and warned the situation was on track to get even worse. Researchers have set out a series of recommendations focused on preventing illness rather than treating it. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes has been looking at the study.
Having diagnosed the serious problems the NHS faces in his review last week, Lord Darzi is now offering solutions in this report. A key issue is the high number of people off work due to long-term sickness. The report says this could reach well over 4 million by the end of the next Parliament. The authors suggest moving from policies based on treating sickness to ones of creating better health. They propose increasing taxes on tobacco, alcohol and unhealthy foods, offering universal free school meals, restoring funding for the Sure Start programme for the under fives, establishing neighbourhood health centres and offering those off sick what they call the right to try work with no risk to existing health or disability benefits.
Donald Trump has spoken publicly for the first time since he was targeted in an apparent assassination attempt at his golf course in Florida. Investigators say the suspect hid in bushes for nearly 12 hours before he was spotted by Secret Service agents who fired at him. He fled and was later arrested. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is in West Palm Beach and sent this report.
Carrying on with his planned schedule despite Sunday's apparent assassination attempt, Donald Trump joined a cryptocurrency personality, Farouk Sarmad, for an online conversation. He described enjoying a round of golf with a friend when they heard shots fired. Mr. Trump said he wasn't sure if it was gunfire, but the Secret Service knew immediately it was bullets and they grabbed him. He praised the agents for doing an excellent job and said he hoped the suspect remained behind bars for a long time. He also talked about a phone call with President Biden.
He was very nice today. He called up to make sure I was okay. To make sure that, do I have any suggestions or anything? Mm-hmm. We do need more people on my detail because we have 50, 60,000 people showing up to events. You know, other people don't have that. But he couldn't have been nicer.
The acting head of the Secret Service told a news conference earlier that the footprint of Mr. Trump's security detail was now almost the same as it was when he was president, as Joe Biden had ordered extra resources to be assigned to him after the shooting in Pennsylvania 2 months ago. Donald Trump said that both of the men who appear to have attempted to kill him were radical leftists and claimed Democrats were using incendiary language about him that was inspiring people to try to kill him.
A study has shown the export of British goods continues to be hit by post-Brexit trade restrictions. Economists at Aston University in Birmingham have carried out a comprehensive analysis of trade data from the 3 years since the UK left the EU. Our economics editor Faisal Islam has been looking at the findings.
Researchers at Aston University have carried out a detailed analysis of how UK-EU trade has changed in value, quantity, variety and destination after the UK officially left the single market at the end of 2020. They found the trade in British goods to the EU declined after Brexit, and that hit became more pronounced last year. The overall fall of 27% in exports to the EU and 32% in imports from the EU compared to where the UK economy would have been without Brexit only tells part of the story. The researchers found that agri-food, textiles and the wood and paper trades have been most affected. Larger EU countries held up better. UK trade with smaller, distant EU nations has been hit hardest, as small-scale exporters avoided sectors with the most customs red tape.
The new government has said it wants a reset of relations with the EU, but has ruled out rejoining the single market and customs union. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, is expected to criticise the government for what he will call its doom and gloom when he closes his party's annual conference later. In his keynote speech, he'll claim his party offers hope instead. From Brighton, here's our political correspondent Damien Grammaticus.
The election saw the Liberal Democrats combine an upbeat campaign with a laser focus on a few key themes: the NHS, the cost of living, sewage. That delivered a record haul of seats. They're hoping the approach continues to work. Advance briefing of Sir Ed Davey's speech suggests he will attack Labour for having a tone of pessimism and defeatism, and say the Lib Dems will focus on fixing the NHS, but in a way that shows ambition for the country. Most of the seats his party gained came from the Conservatives, so he will keep up the attacks on them, saying they were unfit to govern and are unfit for opposition too.
The Labour MP Diane Abbott has told the BBC she was treated like a non-person by Sir Keir Starmer and the party during the row over remarks made about her by the businessman Frank Hester. She claimed that the Labour leader wanted to finish his clear out of the left of the parliamentary party by excluding her. The Hackney North and Stoke Newington MP has been speaking to Newsnight's Victoria Derbyshire.
Diane Abbott was speaking in her first full BBC interview since she was investigated by the party, suspended as a Labour MP, readmitted and then re-elected. After reports emerged that the Conservative donor Frank Hester had said that she needed to be shot, Ms Abbott told Newsnight that she had felt frightened and had received more support from the Westminster leader of the SNP, Stephen Flynn, than Keir Starmer or Labour.
Well, you'd feel that if somebody was threatening to have you shot, you would have felt that your party would have offered you more support, given you advice on safety and security, even kind of commiserated with you, and none of that happened.
Mr. Hester apologised and said the remarks were rude, but had nothing to do with the colour of her skin.
A Labour Party spokesperson said Sir Keir had great respect for Diane Abbott and that he and the party condemned Frank Hester's comments and had reached out to her at the time to offer support. You can hear the full interview on Newsnight tonight on BBC Two and on BBC iPlayer. A zoo in Shropshire has appealed for help to find a giant rodent known as a capybara, which has escaped from its enclosure. The animal, called Cinnamon, was last seen on a road near Hoo Zoo outside Telford on Saturday. People have been warned not to try to catch her themselves if they see her, as she could become unpredictable if cornered.
Jane, thank you very much. It is 8:10. As a new academic year begins, the body which represents 142 universities across the UK wants your attention. It wants the new government to bring about a reset to focus on what it is meant for fees in England to be frozen at just over £9,000 a year for the last 7 years through a time of high inflation. And essentially, it wants the students to pay more and the government to give more. On this programme, we've had a preview of their proposals. If you learn more, you earn more, was the way they put it to us an hour ago. You, our listeners, don't always see it that way. The value of university education was something one group of listeners wanted us to focus on when we asked earlier this year about the issues you wanted us to get stuck into. We have Alan Johnson, former education secretary, coming up in a moment.
But first, here are those listeners, Anna and Chloe, with her 19-year-old daughter, Pearl. They've all been speaking to education correspondent Vanessa Clark.
Is that your university halls?
Yeah, I was probably very nervous deep down, but very excited also.
How much time did you spend in that room?
Probably 20 hours and 24 hours. Looking at this picture now, it just makes me feel a bit sick. I'm Pearl, I'm 19 years old. I dropped out after doing a year of law, and I'm going to Goldsmiths in September.
I'm Chloe, I'm Pearl's mum.
I'm Anna, I'm Chloe's friend, and my son is Theo, who gave up university to become a carpenter.
Pearl, Chloe and Anna, you contacted the Today programme. What exactly do you want us to find out about university education?
Where the money goes, the £9,250 per year plus housing costs. Where does that money go and how can universities explain that it's value for money?
Pearl, what about you?
Where's the personal connection and is it possible to get more face-to-face?
Was it quite a big decision to drop out?
I didn't have the best start. There were a lot of strikes in the first few weeks, so I didn't start for about a month in, which was not great because it's kind of start, stop, start, stop, and they don't really help you get stuck in. Like, if you don't turn up, they don't chase you about anything, they don't encourage you to like pick it back up. There's no kind of conversation about how you're feeling about anything.
That's how it went with Theo as well, my son. He was not going to the lectures and he literally was able to just spiral. There was no support. So he just carried on with non-attendance, and sort of stayed in his room and was just ultimately left to fail.
Yeah, it's pretty faceless.
Yeah.
The whole
and isolating.
Yeah. I don't think it was a wasted year for me because I learned how to do university and how not to do university in the first year. So now going back into year one, I'll know exactly what to do.
For you, Chloe and Anna, there was no tuition fees, was there?
No.
So it was a different decision.
You could kind of try it and then think, well, no, I'm not sure this is right. And actually for me, watching Pearl struggling, knowing that the money is, it's almost like it's ticking away. I want her to have the good experience that it should be.
Both Chloe and Anna have younger daughters who are thinking about applying to university, and I got the sense they were still very much in favour of the idea. But with the rising cost of living, they want to ensure they're still delivering on what students expect. I'm just walking through the Students' Union at Newcastle University. This September, more 18-year-olds from the UK are beginning courses than last year, and it's already getting busy here. I'm heading to meet the chair of the Russell Group, Chris Day, who is also the Vice-Chancellor here.
We expect to take more home students this year than we've ever done. International students, as we're seeing across the board, both undergraduate and postgraduate, the applications and therefore attendances will probably be lower than we'd hoped.
On the way here, I saw a number of students pulling their suitcases, getting ready to join their halls. Our Today listener, Pearl, feels there was a lack of direct interaction between students and staff when she first started her course elsewhere. How much direct contact time are your students getting when they first arrive here?
It's very subject specific. I think this sort of quite understandable concern with contact hours. Some subjects need a lot of it, some subjects deliberately allow more self-directed learning. You might say contact time is sitting in a lecture theatre, you know, with 400 other students and a lecturer at the front, but it isn't really contact, is it? Whereas, you know, if you then took what you'd learnt from that online lecture and then had that 20 class size small group teaching with that lecturer, you might get more out of it. The other thing I would add, of course, sadly, a lot of our students now have to earn a living as well as study. They love the idea that when it's right for them, they can go up into their room, switch the computer on, watch that lecture, watch that tutorial.
There's a lot of talk at the moment about universities struggling financially, talk of fees going up. Do you think fees should increase?
Costs have gone up and our income from our main source, which is home undergraduate students, has stayed flat. We're having to do more for less. I think unless we want to see a sector that either shrinks or where the quality falls in terms of, you know, bigger class sizes, less lectures, then there has to be some more money put into the system. What the balance is between the student paying more or the government, like they used to, putting more in, I would argue that because society benefits and the student benefits, that probably it should be a little bit of both.
Our listener Anna wants to know, where exactly is that money going to go?
it will keep the current quality where it is. The lecturers' salaries, the equipment, the buildings, books, the libraries, all of that stuff that you need to be taught well, that's the main place that their student fees would go.
Is it fair to say that although if the fees go up, people expect to see more actually because of the deficits, it will just fill the current holes in the system?
My view at the minute is if the fees or the taxpayer pays a bit more, what you will stop is a managed decline in the sector of all of this.
So coming back to that central question from our listeners about the value of a university education, what can you do to reassure Pearl, Chloe and Anna? Is university still worth it in 2024?
Absolutely, and I hope everything I've said has convinced them of that. Not for everybody, but for a huge proportion of the population, certainly upwards of 50%. It's difficult to think of a better start to life financially, emotionally, than going to a university like ours.
It's a good night out, isn't it, Professor?
Professor Day says universities are offering more support for students, but across the UK, the number dropping out, like Pearl and Theo, is rising. 41,000 students left last year, with mental health and financial pressures being the main reasons.
Hi, I'm Rose Stevenson. I'm the Director of Policy at the Higher Education Policy Institute, HEPI. University is still worth it for the vast majority of students, but I do think there is work to do on making sure that applicants have clear information about the financial opportunities based on the course that they are choosing. This year, 39% of students felt that the value of their course was good or very good. And that's the highest it's been since 2015. So we have seen some recovery there. But we do have a quarter of students saying that they see poor or very poor value for money in terms of their course. And we do know this year and last year that the cost of living has impacted those answers. Of the students who had considered withdrawing from university, mental health challenges and financial difficulties were the two biggest reasons that were causing them to think maybe they were going to drop out of university.
Pearl's experience of university hasn't put her off. She is keen to start her new course this month. But Anna's son Theo is not going back. I've brought Pearl to Barking Park here in East London to meet Theo after work to hear more about his experience.
Hi, Theo, nice to meet you. I'm Vanessa. And I think you know...
I do know, Pearl. It's been a long time now. How have you been?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, not bad.
So you're now doing an apprenticeship.
Yeah, construction carpentry. I like it a lot. It's very hands-on.
And I think this is something that you both have in similar, because Pearl and Theo, you both dropped out after your first year at university. Can you explain just what happened for you, Theo?
I've just found it quite difficult. Things started piling on top of each other. Stress, debts, everything. And then that just feeling kind of carried on, and I started thinking, why am I going to end up paying a fortune for all of this when I'm not enjoying it? It's a big leap. Like, no one's coming up to you and being like, oh, do you need a bit more help? It's a bit daunting to step up to, I reckon, especially for me as a person that struggles to ask for help anyway. So yeah, I don't exactly make it easy.
I think a lot of people in the first term have that wobble and think, oh, is this actually for me? But no one actually really talks about it.
It feels like there was just a bit of a disconnect between expectation and reality for you.
Well, the expectation is just that you get this piece of gold after 3 or 4 years that is just going to lead you onto better things in life. I think there needs to be a lot more reality discussion of what university can do.
Lastly, the question we're trying to answer is, is university worth it? Do you still think there's a place for university?
I think at university you're going through all these personal things, and then you start noting everything down, reasons to go, and then there's just that big number at the end of it, and you're like, well, that's the kicker, isn't it? For me, if it's a debt too big to put yourself through.
I think definitely do what you want, because at the end of the day you're going to be the one paying for it, and you kind of have to be happy with that to be able to think about paying that back.
And that report was from our education correspondent, Vanessa Clark. Listening to it is Alan Johnson, former Labour MP, served as Education Secretary under Tony Blair, and since last year, the Chancellor of the University of Hull. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think of what you heard?
Well, I'm not surprised. The basic message is university is great, but it's not for everyone. My particular concern is that people from backgrounds that weren't traditionally likely to go to university should get that opportunity. You know, when I was born, only 2% went to university. When I left school, it doubled, but that made it 4%. And that wasn't because the other 96% didn't qualify. It was because they qualified but were kept out of university because the feeling was it should be a privilege for an elite. Now we've got past that. And, you know, these are adults. We're not talking about school students anymore. We're talking about 18-year-olds who vote with their feet. And the fact that we're talking about England here, of course, the fact that there are record numbers of home students this year shows that irrespective of all the arguments about debt, and perhaps we'll come on to that, youngsters still think that it's a fulfilling experience to go to university.
Except look at the number of dropouts. We heard it in that piece, quite shocking, 41,000 last year. Can you say that every single university course in the country is worth 9,250 a year?
No, I think they're worth more, actually, because I think, you know, the fact that they've been frozen effectively
every
since 2010.
One.
They went up once. Yeah, I hold to the Deering principles that started this, that students pay nothing up front. Cost of university is shared by those who benefit. That includes the taxpayer, of course, includes employers. You know, an employer levy, they benefit from a highly skilled workforce. And graduates should make a payment. Graduates, not students, income contingent in years. I mean, most students understand this. I was education secretary 20 years ago. I brought in fees. The people who have struggled to understand it are the adults. The students, who are adults, but younger adults, if you like, the students got it straight away. This is not credit card debt. You pay nothing till you're earning close to $30,000 a year, and then you pay it straight to the treasury, comes out of your pay, you know, basically the cost of a pint of beer. So actually, this is an important part of the funding. Is it? Well, we all thought, I think everyone thought when fees were introduced that universities would have different levels, that they wouldn't all go to the maximum fee. They did, but in a sense, that's another story, because we've been talking about 14 years of almost, Professor Day said it, managed decline of a hostility towards the higher education sector, based on the fact, I think, the principle, it's a concern that it's no longer the privilege of a small elite. You know, we ended that, and I'm proud that we did, and we've got to maintain that value for students. And of course, Chloe and Pearl and Anna were right about some of the issues that need to be tackled. But the funding, the fact that funding, wherever it comes from the taxpayer, from students, from overseas students, has been hit in one way or another, and that universities are in this terrible situation now, we have to do something about that, because universities are a force for good.
Let's just go through then the things that you want to happen now. Fees need to go up, yes?
Yes, the IFS say if you just lift the cap, it's been frozen since 2017, but it only went up once since 2010. But it's been frozen since 2017. Lift that cap, they say,
So what the universities say is that if fees had moved up with inflation, you'd now be at £12,000 to £13,000 a year.
Yeah,
so is that what would you take fees to?
That's not going to happen, Michelle. What IFS say, it's not going to happen because there's not the money to do that. What the IFS say is lift the cap, and by next year there'll be an extra £250 million going into £270 million. And by the end of this parliament, there'll be an extra £1.8 billion into universities. That's just by going back to what we should have, which is fees indexed to inflation. The cost of that, by the way, because of the way fees run and it's off the book, only a quarter of it would fall to the taxpayer. Three quarters of it would fall to the students, but not for 30 or 40 years.
Okay, and but I just want to be clear then. An increase, you think the increase to fees, essentially what the students should be paying rather than now, what they're paying now, what, around 11 or 12,000? Is that what you think the actual annual tuition fees should go to?
I think it would get to that, but by the end of this parliament, but not go there immediately. But the other side of that is maintenance grants, abolished by George Osborne for poorer students, needs to be reintroduced. And the maintenance loan that students get, which used to have to, in your day, and you're sitting there in a studio full of university graduates, you all had to pay it back on a mortgage-based system. Some people had to pay it back within 3 years. You roll that up now, the maintenance loan, and pay it back on the same basis as the fees, you know, in year, once you've graduated, etc. But that has been pinned down at £10,000 for far too long. It needs to be more like £18,000. There needs to be help for university students in this system. But what we don't need is to throw the whole system up in the air. What we don't need is to go back to universities being a preserve of a privileged elite. And what we don't need is some kind of idea that you can manage universities on the basis of what it was like in the 1950s when so few students went there.
Alan Johnson, thank you.
We lost our non-University Today presenter, didn't we, some years ago? Can't remember his name. He wasn't any good anyway. 26 minutes past eight is the time. After what appears to have been a second attempt to kill Donald Trump, the man himself, the Secret Service, the FBI have all been talking about it and suggesting better protection for him and other political leaders as the election campaign in America reaches its high point. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, has been telling me about the conversations and the wider political fallout.
Donald Trump himself has been very, very complimentary of the Secret Service or agents around him who, as soon as they heard shots fired, evacuated him from the golf course. We know that the suspect didn't actually fire a shot. What happened was that a Secret Service agent who was one hole ahead of Donald Trump on the golf course spotted the barrel of a rifle sticking out of the bushes, and they fired four or five shots at the suspect, who then took off without having fired at all. But a briefing about the security arrangements. The Secret Service did admit they had not searched the perimeter of the Trump International Golf Course here in West Palm Beach. And the FBI have information from the suspect's phone that he may have been lurking around that area for almost 12 hours before he was spotted by Secret Service agents. So one assumes that if a perimeter search had been done, they would have found him there. But according to the Secret Service acting director, Roland Rowe, he says that the president was not even really supposed to be going to the golf club. They had to put a security plan together at the last minute. This is what they call in the jargon an off-the-record movement. So they say that with these unscheduled appointments, there's a limit to what they can do in advance.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump as well, talking about it.
Absolutely. He was describing the moment, and also that he had a phone call with President Biden, which he said was very nice. But he pointed out that he thinks he needs more Secret Service agents because of the huge number of people that are turning up at his rallies. And actually, President Biden would appear to agree. I mean, he spoke to reporters earlier, and he said that the service does need more help and that it's Congress who should respond to their needs, i.e. give them more money to pay for more resources. And in fact, the Secret Service themselves have been writing to senators asking for more resources. So it would appear that this is one thing that President Biden and former President Trump may agree upon.
But something they may not agree on is Donald Trump blaming essentially the people who've been campaigning against him for the danger that he is unquestionably in.
Yeah, and he was much, much more direct about this than he was a couple of months ago after the attempted assassination in Pennsylvania. And he has been saying that he really does directly blame President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. He says that that people have been egged on by their rhetoric and what he calls their lies about them. And he's sent out a list of things that he says that these different candidates have said about him, describing him as a threat to democracy or a threat to the nation, which he says basically is inciting people to attempt to kill him. And in the circumstances in which, you know, there have been what appears to be two assassination attempts against him in as many months, you can understand why he's worried.
Are we seeing a new Donald Trump at all? We talked to his friend Chris Ruddy on the programme yesterday, who is frustrated. I mean, made it plain that his friends and indeed his advisers are often frustrated at the things he says and want him to promote, I suppose, a calmer Donald Trump to the nation and think that that would be successful politically for him. Are we seeing any side of that?
Not today. And previously, you know, he immediately after that assassination attempt in Pennsylvania, he talked about being a changed man who was going to conduct his political persona very differently. And that's definitely not what we've seen today. He appears to be quite angry, certainly, at his political opponents and casting doubt about their motives when they are insulting and attacking him. So, I mean, that is ramping up the temperature in what would appear to be a dangerously overheated election. It's certainly not taking the heat out of this situation.
Sarah Smith, thank you.
8:30, Kathy has the sport.
Morning, thank you very much. Liverpool and Aston Villa play the first games of their Champions League campaigns tonight, with the competition taking on a new format involving more clubs and one single table. Liverpool face AC Milan at 8 p.m, while the Aston Villa manager Unai Emery wants his side to win their opening Champions League game against Young Boys at 5:45 in memory of the club's European Cup winner Gary Shaw, who died yesterday at the age of 63. Shaw was in the Aston Villa team that won the competition in 1982. Lord Coe, currently president of World Athletics, has been named as one of seven confirmed candidates to succeed Thomas Bach as the president of the International Olympic Committee. And the Scottish Government is on the verge of agreeing a deal for Glasgow to host the 2026 Commonwealth Games, with an announcement expected today. The original host, the Australian state of Victoria, withdrew because of rising costs. We can speak to Michael Kavanagh, who was chair of Commonwealth Games Scotland when Glasgow hosted the Commonwealth Games a decade ago. Morning, Michael. The state of Victoria was concerned about the financial risk. The Scottish Government says public money will not be used. Would these games have happened at all without a multi-million pound funding offer from Commonwealth Games Australia, do you think?
Yes, I think they would. I mean, a couple of things to say. The state of Victoria created a model which was always going to be expensive. Rather than concentrating in one city, they wanted to spread it across the whole state. So whatever decision they made to withdraw for costs, it was down to their own decisions. It's also good to say that, you know, the non-requirement for public money has been made plain by Commonwealth Games Scotland, who made this proposal quite a few months ago. You know, they said to Scottish Government, in particular, and UK Government, there will be no requirement for public money.
Yeah, and 2026 will be a scaled-down version of 2014 Commonwealth Games, with, I think, somewhere between 10 and 13 sports is the idea at the moment, rather than 18. What are the other things that need to change in order to keep those costs down?
Well, the fact that the sport programme is smaller will obviously reduce costs. The plan also is to make sure everything stays within the city of Glasgow, which is, you know, a fairly tight area, four venues. But those venues are world class, because they were, you know, some of them were built for or upgraded for Glasgow 2014. You know, we have a fantastic indoor arena, the Emirates Arena, with the Cresshoy Velodrome alongside it, available for use. Toll Cross, a world class swimming centre, which has held some European and World Swimming Championships since 2014. So there's no requirement to build anything for the Games, which is usually a big part of the cost.
Yeah, there's also the part of the Games that, you know, those sports that aren't represented at Olympic level, like netball and some smaller nations, that there's an important relevance of the Commonwealth Games for them, I presume, whereas others consider it to be slightly outdated. Is there a concern about reputational damage for Glasgow?
I'm not sure anyone thinks the Commonwealth Games is outdated. I mean, people are entitled to have their view in comparison to any other event, but I think it's always proven itself to be a high-class sporting event. And even with a reduced number of sports, that's exactly what it will be, because that's what the proposal says it's going to be. It's, you know, it's they're going to deliver a Commonwealth Games, yes, a scaled-down version with a smaller number of sports, but it's still going to be a high-class sporting event.
Okay, looking forward to hearing about that later today. Michael Kavanagh, former chair of Commonwealth Games Scotland, thank you very much. And just to mention, the Sir Ben Ainslie's British team, Ineos Britannia, lost a race against Switzerland's Alinghi Red Bull Racing in the semi-finals of Sailing's America's Cup. Ineos Britannia have a 4-1 lead and they need to win one more race to reach the final of the Louis Vuitton Cup against defending champions New Zealand.
Kathy, thank you. Jim Al-Khalili will be here with the Life Scientific in half an hour.
Hello. A gruesome axe murder on the streets of Thebes 3,000 years ago. An English woman who believed she was the reincarnation of an Egyptian priestess. And how to get ancient mummies into the X-ray department of a busy hospital without upsetting the patients. These are just some of the elements in today's Life Scientific. My guest is Professor Rosalie David, who 50 years ago launched a unique project to study Egyptian mummies using the techniques of modern medicine, and opened a new window into the life, death and society in ancient Egypt. That's the Life Scientific, after the news at 9, or catch up on BBC Sounds.
The weather today is expected to become largely dry and settled after showers in the far north diminish.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4, Michelle Hussain and Justin Webb. It is just going up to 25 to 9. Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Universities in England say higher tuition fees and direct government funding are needed to halt a growing deficit. They want annual tuition fees in England, which have been capped since 2017, to be increased in line with inflation. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has said the end of a pay dispute by junior doctors in England marks the first step in the government's mission to make the NHS fit for the future. Members of the British Medical Association voted to accept a 22% pay rise over 2 years. Donald Trump has spoken publicly for the first time since a suspected assassination attempt at his golf course in Florida. In a social media live stream, he praised his protection team and commended President Biden for his response. A 26-year-old man, Carl Clifford, has been charged with the murders of the wife and two daughters of the BBC commentator John Hunt. Carol, Louise and Hannah Hunt died in a crossbow attack at their home in Bushy in July. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, is to warn that crises in climate and nature are the defining challenges of our time. In his first major speech, he will outline plans to build an alliance of countries to accelerate the transition to clean energy.
Thank you. It is 24 minutes to nine. We heard on the programme yesterday about the threat to East Anglia that campaigners say comes from the update to the national grid that's going to be necessary if electricity from offshore wind is going to be distributed around the nation. Fiona Gilmore is campaigning against the building of a huge new energy hub in the Suffolk countryside. Her group believes it should be built offshore instead. She told us yesterday that it gives a sense of the opposition that the government is going to face from other local communities.
The alternative is asymmetric, disproportionate destruction and needless of this extraordinary area where we have some of the most vital wetlands, heathlands, the equivalent of a tropical rainforest. In the name of progress, we do not need to increase our biodiversity loss.
Well, today we're going to get the view of the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, and if the excerpts from his speech released overnight are anything to go by, campaigners have a problem. He talks of a clean energy sprint. He doesn't seem minded to pause that sprint for anything. Let's talk to Emma Pinchbank, who is the CEO of Energy UK, the operator's body, and is here in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
When you hear complaints like that, and that's not certainly the only one, is it? When you hear those complaints, what do you think?
Well, I come from the environmental movement by background and I live in a very beautiful part of the world. So I've always said that I completely understand the emotional response to new infrastructure and wanting to make sure that we're building things in the right places where they will truly benefit the economy. What we've been saying, though, is that we have been moving much more slowly in the UK because of some of our planning restrictions, because of things like our grid connections. And just to give you some context, the environmental statement for Sizewell C, the new nuclear station, was around 40,000 pages long. That's around 40 times the length of the complete works of Shakespeare. So you can, of course, protect local areas. You can work with local communities. They should absolutely benefit from hosting infrastructure. But with a £460 benefit to the UK economy from delivering net zero, we are very clear that we also need to move faster.
What the campaigners say, many of them, is yes, you can deliver all of this stuff. We're not against you delivering it, but we should spend the money that needs to be spent on delivering it in a way that doesn't damage the countryside.
There are lots of different ways that we can deliver this infrastructure. And one of the things that the government has already commissioned the new national system operator to do is to produce a strategic plan so we can see where the infrastructure will be, have a much more complex and nuanced conversation with the public about what we're planning on doing. But we do need to build around five times the amount of infrastructure over the next 5 to 10 years that we've built in the last 30 years.
But for instance, in that case, they're saying you can build it offshore, which would presumably be a lot more expensive someone would have to pay.
Yeah, of course, there are options like building offshore. Indeed, I hear lots of conversation about things like undergrounding cables. And the truth is, it's project by project. And of course, we all fund this infrastructure, which is to the good of the national economy. And so one of the jobs for government is to literally work out what those local versus national trade-offs are. Undergrounding can be on average 5 to 10 times more expensive, and we all fund that through our bills. So it's about looking across the whole system and making sure we do this in a fair way.
Perhaps we shouldn't fund it through our bills, though. Perhaps we should fund it through central government funding, and otherwise through our taxes. And if we are going to spend a lot of money and potentially do quite a lot of damage to our country, we ought to have a new conversation about that. Is that something the industry is open to having?
One of the things I'm going to say in my speech, as a spoiler alert for later today, is exactly that the two big challenges, I think, for this decade to come are around delivering a lot of infrastructure at speed, appropriately, working with local communities, but also funding it fairly across society as a whole. And one of the things we were campaigning for in the run-up to the general election is to do things like rebalance those policy costs away from energy bills, particularly the costs that are on electricity, which are often preventing people from getting the benefits of things like heat pumps and electric vehicles and the household level technologies that work very effectively with the large scale renewables we're building on the other end of the system.
Is there also a role for local communities in a very local sense benefiting from things that they allow to happen around them? So this is a discussion we've had on and off on the programme actually for years, and I'm not sure it's ever really got anywhere. Is there something in that direction that you think could work in this country?
Yeah, we are doing work with that, and already some of the developers offer things like bill discounts around onshore wind farms. All of the developers offer big community benefit funds around their infrastructure, and we would welcome a broader conversation about that with government. I think it's part of what they're trying to do with their local power plan. I'd also say the last time we did a grid upgrade of this scale, there was a big public information campaign. My grandfather sent me the links to the old Pathé films that used to play in the cinemas in the 60s. And we need that kind of national effort again. Back then, the conversation was, why should we build wind turbine, or why should we build pylons in England to help Welsh farmers out? And it's the same conversation 30 years later. I'd love to see that same level of national effort.
Emma Pinchbank, CEO of Energy UK. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is just after 20 to 9. If you've ever seen people delivering food orders on electric bikes go faster than you think they should, direct your annoyance to the companies, their union is suggesting today. It says companies like Deliveroo, Uber Eats and Just Eat use a pay-per-drop, essentially pay-per-job, a model that encourages illegal modifying of e-bikes so they can go faster. Shaf Hussain is chair of the couriers branch of the IWAG union and a full-time rider himself. Good morning, Shaf.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Explain what happens.
Can you please expand on your question?
What are you saying is going wrong? That the riders are under so much pressure that they need to modify their electric bike so they can go faster than the limit?
Well, I'm not actually aware of any modifications that drivers are actually making. The riders are effectively forced on to make timescale deliveries. They're effectively forced to make a decision between putting food on the table or surviving the next day, dodging traffic. You know, I worked as a courier for the past 8 years, and for me, all I've seen is the pay go down continuously. I've worked since 2016, and honestly, it's like, you know, for us, we see Deliveroo and Uber Eats pay out massive millions to their shareholders. Deliveroo, for example, in the past year has actually paid out over £300 million to their shareholders, while, you know, we're basically paid next to nothing. We're paid as minimum as £290 in London and a lot less outside of London. You know, so when you say riders are effectively modifying their bikes, I'm unfortunately not aware of that. All I'm aware of the fact that we're actually not given any rights, we're effectively scapegoated by these companies for the outlining issue, which is actually pay and conditions for riders.
And I want to explore that, but I also want to explain why I said that. It's because the City of London Police says it sees, that's just one area, one force, but it sees more than 300 illegally modified e-bikes since launching a crackdown last year. And a lot of those bikes are used by people who do these jobs. And that's why I asked the question. But let's turn to what you're saying about Deliveroo. Now, they say, I mean, all the companies involved, Just Eat, Uber Eats, Deliveroo, they reject this idea of incentivizing anyone to take risks. But Deliveroo specifically say they guarantee that all riders earn at least £12 an hour plus expenses.
Well, here's the thing. As I've said, I've worked 8 hours. I've worked 8 years on the Deliveroo platform since 2016, and I've never seen my pay go up. I've only seen it go down. I used to be paid £7 per hour plus £1 for every drop I used to make above the London living wage back in 2016. But now I struggle to make that. I could literally show you my pay stubs. I could show you screenshots. And, you know, the pay has always declined over the years. I will receive a £8 order to travel 10 miles, but then while going to that order, I'll receive another 10 orders paying £1 to travel that same 10 miles.
So are you saying that this idea that everyone's earning at least £12 an hour, this is based on assumptions that are wrong about what you can do in an hour?
This is based on timescales that Deliveroo estimates on themselves. We definitely don't make the London living wage. For us, it's, you know, we have to take account of the time we spend in going to the restaurant. We need to take into account the traffic level. We need to take into account how long we're staying at our restaurant. A lot of the times it's half an hour. A lot of the times it's an hour we're waiting for the food. And then we have to travel to the customer, and then we have to wait for the customer in some cases. So if you take all of that in account, we're literally waiting, say, 40 minutes within that time scale. But again, you know, it's the underlying issue is the pay. We're not paid enough to actually do our jobs.
Chef Hussein, thank you very much.
And that brings us to 14 minutes to nine.
A man has been charged this morning with murder after the crossbow attacks on the wife and two daughters of the BBC racing commentator John Hunt. Steve Nibbs, BBC reporter, is here in the studio. What do we know from court this morning?
Yeah, morning, Michelle. Well, this goes back to the 9th of July. Carol, Hannah and Louise Hunt were found fatally injured in Bushey in Hertfordshire. We reported it extensively at the time. The next day, police arrested Kyle Clifford. He was very injured. He was in a serious condition in hospital. And at the time, police said that a crossbow had been found during their inquiries. We've had a statement in the last hour from Hertfordshire Constabulary saying that detectives from the major crime unit have now questioned Kyle Clifford. He's 26 years old, from Enfield. And last night they charged him with three counts of murder, forced imprisonment and two counts of possession of offensive weapons. He's been remanded in custody and will appear at Westminster Magistrates this morning. Detective Chief Inspector Nick Gardner's from the Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire Major Crime Unit. He said in the last hour, "Our thoughts remain with the Hunt family and their loved ones as they continue to come to terms with their loss. Over the last couple of months, we've been working hard to gather as much evidence as possible and establish the full circumstances of what happened that day. Today, we've managed to secure charges against Carl Clifford in connection with the murders of Carol, Hannah and Louise Hunt. Although it has taken some time," he says, "to reach this stage, we can now move forward with the judicial process and seek justice."
Among the many shocking details of this was the weapon used, the crossbow. What are the rules around such items?
Well, this was something that at the time the Prime Minister Keir Starmer was asked about this. There was calls on the government to look into crossbow legislation, and he confirmed that that would happen, as did Home Secretary Yvette Cooper. She said that adding crossbow laws would be reviewed as a real priority at the time. Of course, this was back in early July last year.
Steve Nibbs, thank you.
The time, 12 minutes to nine. Dancing with the Stars is known for its glitz and its glitter, a staple of US TV for almost 20 years now. But during the show's primetime season premiere, there is going to be a twist. The convicted fraudster, Anna Delvey, real name Anna Sorokin, takes to the floor wearing a bejeweled ankle monitor. The BBC journalist, co-creator of the BBC's Fake Heiress podcast, Vicky Baker, is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Quite a moment. Start us from the beginning. Who is she and why has she ended up on Dancing with the Stars?
Well, yeah, it's been quite a long story. Anna is a convicted fraudster. Between 2013 and 2017, she went around New York masquerading as the heiress to an enormous trust fund. She was trying to secure a $22 million loan to set up an eponymous art centre, which she said would be akin to Soho House. And it was all lies. Her real name is Anna Sorokin. She didn't have a penny to her name. And yet she stayed in these luxury hotels, flew in private jets, racked up enormous bills that she couldn't pay. And ultimately, she was caught while on the run in California. And that's when her story was first reported in the media, and it blew up on social media. And she faced a fairly high profile trial after that and was convicted on various theft related charges and jailed. She's since been released. And now she's been cast on Dancing with Stars.
And she's been released with a tag.
Well, the tag actually, it relates to a different issue. So when she was released in 2021, originally, she didn't leave the US. So she'd served her time in jail. She served just under 4 years in jail and was free to return to Germany. She's a German-Russian citizen. And she didn't go. She was arrested by US immigration authorities then, was sent back to jail, and she's been fighting that ever since 2021. So she spent a period under house arrest, and she's just had her bond restrictions relaxed so she can go on the show.
When you did this series about her, this fake heiress podcast, which I think is still up, isn't it? It's on BBC Sounds. When back in 2019 or so, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you always think, well, that's the end of the story. Yes. And somehow she keeps coming back.
But, I mean, which makes her a rather extraordinary person. But, I mean, if you were the victim of her crimes, I suppose you wouldn't feel that. Were the crimes victimless in the sense that there weren't individuals who are chasing money now that they've lost their life savings? Or, I mean, what allows her to be able to trade on this celebrity now and have this very high profile role in American fun life, I suppose, that you wouldn't afford to an ordinary criminal?
Exactly. I mean, it's extraordinary. And the original crimes, I wouldn't say, were victimless. There were some individuals and some small businesses that she ended up owing large amounts of money to. And there is, as you say, it's always been a kind of polarized reaction to her, both in person and online. Some people seem pulled in, others are instantly repelled. Some appear to admire her endless ambition as if it represents some sort of warped American dream, but others find that continued self-promotion and seeming lack of remorse quite shameless. But it always gets attention. I think people have forgotten, like, the original crimes and what it was that she did. And I mean, Dancing with the Stars, as far as I understand, has had a lot of controversial characters on it in the past, and does kind of try to sort of play this redemption arc.
In their press release, ABC, Disney owned ABC, calling her a notorious ankle bracelet fashionista.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite the plug. In many ways, that's the narrative that she's always, well, less the ankle bracelet. I'm sure she's not delighted with that. But a lot of this kind of fashionista persona is what she always portrayed and how she wanted to be viewed.
OK, well, look, Fake Heiress is still there on BBC Sounds to be listened to if people are interested in her. Sounds like you'll have to do an update as well. Vicky Baker, thanks.
7:07 is the time. Women have been having babies forever. Now, thanks to a new study on brain scans, we have an idea of what pregnancy does to the brain. You may be thinking brain fog, but listen on, because this is about which areas shrink or expand over the months of a pregnancy and what that tells us. We're joined by the science writer Lucy Jones, author of the new book Matrescence, on the metamorphosis of pregnancy, childbirth and motherhood, and by Professor Liz Krastel, who was involved in the study that's just been published in Neuroscience and also contributed scans of her own brain to it. Welcome. Morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning. Delighted to be here.
Professor Krastel, tell us then, what emerged from the scans of your brain and others?
Yes, exactly. So thanks for having me here. What emerged was that the brain is a remarkably plastic and malleable organ. And we found was a widespread reduction in brain volume across the 9 months of pregnancy, resulting in about a 4% reduction in gray matter volume. But most interestingly, it was that we also found this interesting strengthening of the white matter, which is the neural connections between different parts of the brain, which is the axons of the neurons. And these actually had improvement in their integrity, which then returned back to baseline. But it was an interesting thing that we wouldn't have found otherwise.
Okay. Can I just ask you to translate some of this into sure. into layman's terms? Okay.
Now, trying to do my best.
This sounds like what we might think of as brain fog, reductions in brain volume and decreases in gray matter.
Yeah, well, you know, it's surprising. You might think it's a negative, but it may not be. And so what we're trying to find out is exactly what this means, for, you know, people experiencing pregnancy. But, you know, our brains have undergone, you know, millions of years of evolution as people have been, going through pregnancy and creatures have been going through pregnancy for forever. And so we think this is sort of a fine tuning, in a way that helps, reveal things that might be important for maternal care. And so we think about this as similar to something that happens during adolescence when the brain actually also goes through a reduction and changing in the connectivity and so forth, which is actually important for neural development at different time points in our life. And so we think this is similar.
Lucy Jones, what do you think of this study?
I think it's a fantastic and really groundbreaking study, which matters because the transition to motherhood and parenthood in our society, what we now call matrescence or putrescence, has been a neglected and ignored developmental transition, which comes with vulnerability. I imagine most people listening won't know that the brain in pregnancy changes shape in multiple areas. We know more about the ocean floor and outer space than we do about the female brain. No one tells you in antenatal classes what's happening to your brain. And considering high rates of maternal mental health problems, isolation, loneliness, birth trauma, grotesque inequalities and survival outcomes across race lines show how much we need a new understanding of this transition, because as a society, we're continuing to fail new mothers. Since publishing Matrescence, where I researched the latest neuroscience, hundreds and hundreds of women have written to me. And I have a strong sense that although we desperately need systemic and structural change, knowing that becoming a mother is a time of seismic change transforms the experience for mothers and, of course, caregivers and fathers. We know that with hands-on affectionate caregiving, caregiver brains change as well.
And yet we are told, at least I remember being, you know, actually told by the NHS, pregnancy is not an illness, which is, of course, right. It's a part of the human condition for most women.
Yes, and these brain changes are obviously doing wonderful things. Presumably they are fine-tuning the brain in order to care for a baby, so the baby and parent will survive. But with neuroplasticity, as we understand with adolescence, comes with vulnerability to severe stress. So the research is starting to show us that in this plastic time of the brain changing, new mothers who experience social factors such as poverty or racism, domestic violence, previous mental health conditions, will be more vulnerable to severe stress. And this means that as a society, we need to get better at social support and to recognise that this is a transition which we are neglecting.
Professor Krustal, because yes, part of this was your own scans, how did the findings correspond with what you were feeling at the time? So if your scan showed, I'm rather assuming that you were following them during the pregnancy, but if your scan showed that that there were decreases in grey matter at a particular point, was it at a time when you might have found certain aspects of life or cognitive ability difficult?
So we actually did not look at any of the scans during the time. We didn't look at them until well after we were done with the study. So I never was able to do that in time purposely, right? So we didn't want to be able to affect the study that way. But I will say, you know, subjectively, I didn't experience any sort of brain fog or feelings of cognitive decline of any kind, right? So I felt perfectly normal throughout. But I think, you know, part of that is again, these are subtle changes, right? It's not like you're, you know, completely different person, right? But this is sort of thinking about ways that, again, our brains might be fine-tuning, you know, subtle behaviors that might help with maternal care.
And briefly,
need to know more.
Briefly, after birth, did the brain go back to how it was before?
A little bit. So there was a little bit of a rebound in the volume, and the white matter improvements actually returned back to baseline. So some things returned, but actually